Hare Krishna. So welcome to our last session today on the topic of make your destiny. I'll be talking briefly today and then we can have a long question answer session. So till now we have discussed about what destiny is, how it influences us, and how we can, within whatever circumstances we are put in, we can create a better destiny for ourselves in terms of what we will get in future. So I'll talk today primarily in terms of this sense that destiny determines what happens to us, but our free will is to choose how we respond. So how we can respond positively, constructively to what the things that happen in our life, that we will talk in terms of an acronym, TAB. T-A-B. So our thoughts, our attitudes and our behaviors. These are always within our capacity to change. Even if the circumstances that come in our life, the events that happen in our life, those we may not be able to change. But these three are the things which we can change. And the more we learn to change these things, the more we can actually become empowered to create a brighter future for ourselves. Now, the word tab here has in computer browsers, we open a particular window that is called a tab. And there's another tab. So if sometimes we turn on a computer and then the browser opens a particular page as its home page by default. Now, sometimes when that home page opens up, that may not be a page that we want to open. Sometimes some programs, while installing, they put their own software's page as the home page. And then as soon as we turn on the software, immediately that program starts opening up. So we may just, if you don't want to go to that home page, just close that home page and close that tab and open another tab. But that's a mechanical process. And we may have to do that initially. But if you can go into the settings of the browser and find out, where is the setting for the home page? And I find the setting for the home page and change that. Then whatever was my earlier automatically opening, that will not open. Something else will open. So these two, so one thing is when the, it's not that because something has opened in the open home page, we have to read over there, we have to watch over there. No, we can avoid that. We can open some other new tab. So these two are the aspects of, first is closing whatever tabs, whatever pages have opened unnecessarily, which we against our will. And second is changing the settings so that those pages don't open. These are the two aspects of self-transformation. The Bhagavad Gita in the 18th chapter talks about Shama and Dama. Shama is peacefulness or control of the mind. And Dama is control of the senses. Shama and Dama. Now, suppose if we are inside a house and we have got a treasury over there, we have got some precious jewels over there, and we know outside that room particularly, there is a thief. Then, if we know the thief is there outside, what we will do is we will close the door, bolt it, latch it, and never open it. Then the thief will not be able to come in. But if somehow we leave the door open because of negligence or whatever, and a thief just barges in, it's not that because the door has been left open and the thief has barged in, we let, come on, whatever you want to steal, you can steal. No, then we push from inside, try to push the thief out, and again lock the door. So, that the first aspect, like closing the door so that the thief doesn't come in itself, that is like mind control. Keeping the mind peaceful so that negative or lower thoughts and desires don't come in only. Keeping the mind constructively focused so that nothing negative comes into the mind. But when that doesn't work, somehow some negative things come in. It does not mean that just because the negative thoughts have come, that means we have to do something negative. We can fight that out. So, Shama and Dama. This is mind control, if you can keep the mind constructively focused, that is the best. But even if the mind gets agitated, we don't have to necessarily act on that agitation. Sometimes some people may behave in irritable ways and they may get to our nerves. Now, we may not be able to avoid that, but we can avoid expressing that immediately. We need to express that, but we can express that later when we are calmer, when they are calmer, and we can have a reasonable discussion. So this, the stimulus that comes upon us from outside, what that is the part of the circumstances that we face, that is what is going to come by destiny. That we may have certain people around us who are irritable, we may have a particular kind of a body which is prone to sickness, we may have a job which is very demanding, whatever it is, we may be in a particular situation, that is not necessarily in our control. So that comes to us because of our destiny. But within that, we have choices. And to analyze what choices we have, okay, this particular situation has come. I have a person who behaves very irritably with who. What do I do in this such a situation? So often we may say that, oh, we should be more tolerant. Yes, that is true, we should be more tolerant. But what does that mean? If there is a stimulus which is coming from outside and there is a response that comes from inside, so how do we create a distance between the stimulus and the response by which we can choose a healthier response? So for that we can analyze what happens between a stimulus and a response in terms of these three things: our thoughts, our attitudes, and our behaviors. So Dr. Viktor Frankl was one of the most prominent psychologists of the last century, and he wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning. And he was a Nazi captive. He had been captured in Germany at the time of Hitler's Holocaust operation, and he lived in a very horrible condition at that time. And because there were so many Jews who had been imprisoned in the gas chambers, so at that time the Jews themselves, the Germans had arranged in such a way that the Jews had to live on very, very meager supplies. So for example, they would just get a meal of soup with some very little vegetable, otherwise just liquid. So there you observe that even in that situation, when even the basic needs were not available, so he found that different people responded differently. So for example, the food, they had some prisoners among the Jews itself who had been appointed, you had to serve the food. So he found that there also some people, when they would serve the food, they would serve all the liquid to the others and they would keep the solid vegetables for themselves so that they could take it later. Others, they would stir it and mix it nicely and give an equal proportion of solid liquid to everyone. And some others, you know, they would give the solid to others and keep the liquid for themselves. So although they were in a prison situation, still there was that freedom. The point is that from the perspective of how, say, most of us live, that situation was still very restrictive. But even within that restricted situation, recognize that they still have freedom how they act in that situation. So, whatever situation we are in, we may or may not be able to change that situation. Now, the question, why me? Whenever some problems come in our life, the normal question comes, why me? The question, why me, is often a shortcut to frustration. The question, why me, is often simply a shortcut to frustration. Because even if we say that it is because of karma, whatever karma I have done in the past life, but we don't know the specifics of the karma. And it will be very life will become very complicated if we start living in a perpetual flashback mode, constantly remembering, oh, I did this, so I got that, I got this, this is because of which I got that. We will not be able to live in the present or focus on the future. So rather than the question, why me, a much more productive question is, how now? Okay, how should I act now? What is the best response in this situation? How should I act now? How now? The why me question is a question that chokes us under frustration. Often resentment of reality hurts us much more than reality. There is a reality, and the reality may be troublesome. But the resentment of reality hurts us much, much more than the reality itself. So when we resent some situation that has come in our life. Now, I'm not saying that every situation that has come in our life, we have to just passively accept it. We may work to change it. We may work to improve the situation, alter the situation. But whatever we need to do, we need to use our intelligence and and be calm while deciding. But when we are resentful, at that time, our energy is so much choked in negativity that whatever we do, it is more of a knee-jerk reaction, which makes the problem worse than what it needs to be. So, if we can focus on recognizing that, okay, why me? That has no answer. And better not go into that zone too much. How now? How can I act in this situation? And how now involves these three things. Thinking, our thoughts, our attitudes, and our behavior. So here when I talk about thoughts, it is not just thoughts about that particular situation. It is our default thoughts, our default pattern of thoughts. See, all, just as we have a home, and we may go out for this work, we may go out for that job, we may go out for it, but then we want to go back home. And home is a place where we feel comfortable, we feel joyful. In fact, in English, there's a phrase, feel at home. That means be comfortable. We feel comfortable, secure, relatively satisfied at home. So just as we have a home for the body, we all have a home for our thoughts. A home for our thoughts means that when we have nothing else to do, where do our thoughts go naturally? Now, for some of us, the thoughts may go towards money. For some of us, the thoughts may go towards sensual pleasures. Some of us, the thoughts may go towards prestige. Some people, the thoughts may go towards cricket. For some people, the thoughts may go towards video games. For some people, the thoughts may go towards movies. So, whatever it is, we all have some home for our thoughts. And that home is often not a place that really gives us rest and rejuvenation. We have a particular home for our thoughts. So, people may say that, okay, you know, when I want to relax, I just watch TV. Yes, when I watch TV, all the anxieties and worries that are there, I can just forget them for some time. So we can look at ourselves and say, okay, when we feel disturbed, when we feel bored, when we feel irritated, at that time, what do we by nature think about? You know, when we want to know what a person is, when we introduce people, we say, okay, what do you do? Or who are you? What are you? We say, I'm an engineer, I'm a doctor. Yes, that is an important marker of who a person is, you know, what they normally do. But an equally important marker of who we are for our own growth, for our own self-understanding and for our own growth is to look at what we do when we don't have anything to do. What we do when we don't have anything to do. Then that will help us to understand what our default thoughts are. And that is the home for our thoughts. And now when say somebody is next TV watching as the home for their thoughts, when I have nothing to do, I just turn on the television and watch the television. Now yes, that might give us some comfort, that might give us some relief. But this relief is quite often a relief that is primarily a painkiller. It is not a curative medicine. We get relief. There are various forms of entertainment, various forms of titillation. They give relief. But it is a painkiller. The painkiller doesn't cure the disease. It doesn't cure the pain. It covers the pain. When it covers the pain, we feel, oh, I'm getting relief. But after some time, If a person keeps taking only the painkillers, then after some time, because internally the disease is becoming worse and worse and worse. So after some time, they find that the painkiller doesn't work. At least at that dosage, it doesn't work. And then we need a much stronger painkiller. And then a further stronger painkiller, a further stronger painkiller. So when this happens, then a particular time comes when no matter how strong a dosage of painkiller is given, it doesn't help much because the disease has become so bad. So we all have various kinds of shelters for our thoughts. And those shelters, they offer a little shelter, but over a period of time, they end up creating greater agitation. So we may watch television, may feel, oh, I feel relaxed when I watch television. Yes, we may feel some relaxation. But quite often when we watch television, whatever we watch on the television may kindle our greed, may kindle our lust, may kindle our our anger within us. And it may fuel desires which actually agitate us more and more. So in that way, whatever it is, that for example, people may watch sports, somebody may watch cricket. Now, it's a sports may seem to be like a relatively harmless form of entertainment. Yes, there's some entertainment over there. But if you look at it from simple point of view of mathematics, suppose there's a World Cup in which 16 countries are participating. So then basically, out of them only one country is going to win the World Cup. That means 15 countries, people are going to be miserable. One country, the people are going to be happy. So, and that happiness is also going to last for a brief time. It's not going to be much. So, it's not a shelter that shelters always. It's a shelter, but it doesn't always shelter. Sometimes somebody may watch a cricket match, and then if your favorite team loses, and you end up feeling more frustrated than we started off while watching the match. So quite often, whatever we take shelter of, whatever is the default shelter for our thoughts, that is not a shelter which shelters constantly. The best such shelter is ultimately Krishna. Dhautatma purushah Krishna padamulam namunchati mukta sarva parikleshah pantha swasharanam yatha. So the Bhagavatam gives an example that the pure soul, Dhautatma, purified soul, Purushaha, Krishna, it's a person, Padamulam Namunchati, it's a person never gives up the shelter of Krishna. Why? Mukta Sarva Parikleshaha. Because in the remembrance of Krishna, in the absorption in Krishna, there is freedom from all misery. Mukta Sarva Parikleshaha. Pantha Swasharanam Yatha. The example is of Pantaha, a person, a traveler who has gone far and wide, and the traveler after a long troubled journey comes back to one's home. Swasharanam yatha. Just as a traveler after a troubled journey on coming back home feels relief. Similarly, our thought, they may go here, there, everywhere, but when they come back to Krishna, we experience relief. So the process of bhakti is not just about coming to a temple or chanting the holy names or attending the classes. All these are important. But all these are meant to be tools by which we make Krishna the home for our thoughts. We make Krishna our inner shelter. That means our thoughts may go in various directions, but then we get them back to Krishna. And this, the shelter that comes in absorption in Krishna, that sense of shelter will increase more and more as we become more and more purified. Initially, when we are practicing bhakti, we may feel that, okay, fixing the mind on Krishna is a big labor. It's a big effort. Yes, it is an effort. But if we keep practicing bhakti, then we start to realize, we start getting a taste. Yattadagre vishamiva pariname amritopamam. That sukham sattvikam proktam atma buddhi prasadajam. In 18.36 in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, that which tastes like poison in the beginning, pariname amritopamam, but eventually tastes like poison. That is happiness in the mode of goodness, that is enlightened happiness. So, we, when we practice bhakti, we make Krishna as the home for our heart. And as Krishna becomes the home for our heart, our connection with Krishna gives us strength. It gives us rejuvenation. It gives us relief and release. Relief means we don't feel so much agitated. Release means there's a channeling of our emotions. We may feel burdened, we may feel crushed, but our emotions get spiritually channeled. Just like if, say, now it's very hot outside. When we are hot, we may be sweating. We may be feeling very uncomfortable. But then as soon as we come into a room where there's air conditioning, we feel relief. So like that, our thoughts go here and there and they get agitated. Tapanti vividhas tapa naitan madgata chetasaha. But when our thoughts come to Krishna, they shelter in Krishna, the miseries are there. Outside still the heat is there. But when we come into a room where there is AC, we don't feel that heat. Similarly, when we start practicing bhakti, the problems when they're still in life. But when we find the shelter of Krishna, when we take the shelter of Krishna, it is like we are bringing our thoughts in a Krishna conditioned room. And our thoughts come in a Krishna conditioned room, we get relief. So this is the first aspect in terms of when we practice bhakti. We are talking about how we create a positive destiny for ourselves by offering ourselves a shelter that is rejuvenating, that is elevating. We actually move, we conserve and channel our inner energy. When we don't get a shelter mentally, our thoughts are very restless. And then we can't do much. Even when we work, we are not able to achieve substantially. See, often we analyze our day and we think, okay, morning I have to do this, afternoon I have to do this, evening I have to do this, night I will do this. And we usually, when we talk about taking stock of our time, deciding where we spend our time, we usually divide our day in terms of activities. And I think this activity takes this much time, that activity takes that much time. That's true. But actually, our time is taken not just by our activities. Our time is also taken by our thoughts. So for example, if I'm going for a class, and just before going for a class, I just see someone and I greet them, but they don't even look at me, they snub me, knowingly. I get so angry. And then I go in the class, and I'm sitting there for 1 hour, but in that 1 hour, I am having revenge fantasies. Next time when I see them, I'll snub them in public. Now what has happened? Although we think that that 1 hour I spent in the class, I did not spend in the class actually. That one thought which came from that particular stimulus, that thought of getting back to the person, that consumes the full hour. So actually, if we think of our time as being consumed only by activities, we often don't realize that we may be doing a particular activity externally, but we may not be able to focus on that activity, and that's why that time is not going in that activity, it's just getting wasted. So if we could conserve our mental energy and channel our mental energy, even in the same 24 hours, we would be able to do much more. So when we invest our time in practicing bhakti, when we chant the holy names, when we come to the temple, when we hear classes, what is all this doing? This is actually giving us better control over our mental energy. So once we start practicing bhakti, we make Krishna our home. So okay, somebody snubs me, I feel irritated, I feel bad. But instead of just thinking about that person, I chant the holy names, I think about Krishna, I pray to Krishna. Okay, they snubbed me, I felt bad, but then it's not the end of the world. I don't have to. They snubbed and went away, but they hurt me for a minute, but I don't have to hurt myself for an hour because of that. I'll see how to deal with that later. So if we have cultivated a shelter for our thoughts, then that shelter enables us to regroup whenever we get agitated, and it enables us to deal with the situation more positively. So our thoughts, if we have a default positive shelter for our thoughts, then that enables us to see whatever happens in our life positively. And that brings us to attitude. So TAB, we're talking about opening a new tab in our life. So thoughts is basically the default home for our thoughts. But attitudes refers to specific events that are happening, how we look at those events. So in the Mahabharata, when Abhimanyu is killed on the 13th day of the war, at that time Yudhishthir is afflicted by a crippling attack of guilt, because Yudhishthir feels that it was I who sent Abhimanyu to fight into the Kaurava camp to break the Chakravyuha, and I had promised him that we will be following you and we will protect you, but I could not keep my word, and Abhimanyu was trapped and Abhimanyu was killed, and he is horrified and he becomes so agitated, he doesn't know what to do. He says, you know, how can I face Arjuna, how can I show my face to Subhadra, how can I, what will I tell Uttara, and as he thinks like this, he says, I will go and fight and I will take revenge, and if I can't take revenge, I will lay down my life. And in the night itself, as the sun is about to set, at that time he charges into the Kaurava camp. When he charges into the Kaurava camp, at that time Vyasadeva comes over there, and seeing the Yudhishthira, although he is very disturbingly the cultured king, he gets off his chariot and offers a respect to Vyasadeva, and he pours out his heart to Vyasadeva. Abhimanyu has been killed, and so brutally killed, and I feel responsible for this. So Vyasadeva consoles him and he says, no one in this world, no matter how powerful, how virtuous, how illustrious they may be, no one can violate the law of death. No one can violate the law of death. That means everyone has to die. And he goes on and gives an elaborate discourse to console him. But the concluding point he makes is, the inscrutable will of the Lord is surely for the well-being of all living beings. That the Lord's will is inscrutable. We may not know specifically why something is happening, but we know that ultimately Krishna is our well-wisher. Whatever he does, he has our good in his heart. And then, the Lord's will may be inscrutable, but it is for the well-being of all living beings. And tells him, if you do his will, you will understand this in due course of time. If you do his will. So do not give in to your impulses, do not give in to your lamentation, but act maturely. And he tells him that in 5 days, this war will be over and you will be enthroned as the king. Then Yudhishthira calms down over there. So when we look at situations in our life, now when we see that, something is suddenly going, I'm just going through my life and suddenly I get some disease, or there's some misunderstanding and some relationship gets spoiled, and I lose my job, or so many things can go wrong in our life. When such a thing happens, at that time, how do I respond to it? There are basically for us, when we see life's adversities, we have 3 courses of responses. One is to think that everything happens by chance and my luck was rotten. So now, if we look at it that way, then no God in Satyam Pratishthante Jagadahu Ranishwaram Prasvara Sambhutam Kimanyat Kamahetukam. In 16.8 in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna talks about how demoniac people think there is no God in control. So everything that happens, it just happens by chance. Now, if you think like this, I was just unlucky and that's why this happened, then it's actually a worldview of hopelessness. It makes us very insecure. Okay, now this went wrong, now tomorrow what will go wrong, after what may go wrong. I don't know any of these things. And we make ourselves hopeless. The other worldview is that whatever happens, it is by God's will. Now when you start thinking it is by God's will, everything that happens, then it makes God appear very partial. You know that, things are going on so nicely in that person's life, and things, there are so many problems in my life. So now, The Abrahamic religions are Judaism, Christianity, Islam. They all accept Abraham as one of their primary prophets. So they have the idea that we have only one lifetime. And although there are mentions of reincarnation in their worldviews also, but they don't talk so much about it. Their mainstream expressions don't accept reincarnation right now. They say that whatever happens to us, it's a test from God. Okay, fine. Whatever problem you get, it's a test from God. Yes, we can say it's a test from God. But the problem is not that there's a test. The problem is why there is differential testing. You know, if there is a class and after the class the teacher gives a question paper. And one student gets a very easy paper and another student gets a very difficult paper. The student's question will not be why I'm having an exam. And why are there different papers for everyone? So like that, when we go through our life, when we see this person has this kind of problem, but I have this problem. And why do I have such big problems? Why do I have such, they have such less problems? When we see this difference, and we are told everything happens by God's will, then it appears as if God Himself is capricious. Now God is arbitrarily sending difficulty in one person's life and is giving an easy life for someone else. And then it becomes very difficult to devote oneself or to surrender oneself to such a God, such a conception of God. But the Vedic understanding is that, so to put another, to give another example for the situation, that how the Vedic understanding helps us to deal with the problem of evil, the problem of bad things happening to good people, that we can understand with the example of say cricket. Now suppose there are two teams who start a cricket match, and say one team, say now the IPL is going on, and suppose there are two teams who are playing, one team the starting score is 0, another team the starting score itself is 150. Mm-hmm. Say, hey, this is, something is wrong here, how can they start with a score of 150? So now if you see that the starting score is 150, one message, one explanation could be, you know, this scoreboard itself is wrong. The scoreboard doesn't operate according to the law, the scoreboard operates by chance. So by chance this team has got a score of 0, team has got a score of 150. Now, how do I play a match like that? If anybody gets any score at start, it appears very unfavorable. It appears very unfair. And somebody else says, okay, you know, the person who is keeping the scoreboard, the organizer of the match, they are biased. That's why they have given one team a score of 0, they have given another team a score of 150. That also feels very unfair. The first idea is that, okay, we all get a start, we get a score in our life. Some people are wealthy, some people are poor, some people are good looking, some people not so good looking. Why is this difference there? Oh, it's by chance. That's like the scoreboard operates on its own. Some people say, no, it's by God's will. That's like the person who is organizing the match, that organizer says, oh, they will start with this score, they will start with this score. That also seems very unfair. But if we consider that this is a starting score is this, but the third possibility is that suppose it's not a one-day match. Say it's a match, a test with a multiple innings. And a particular team has got a higher score and a lead from a previous match, previous innings. So if one team is starting with a score that seems to be 150, that means they have scored more in their previous match. So similarly, if we look at our life, so different people have different sets of situations, different kinds of situations, different kinds of problems. So we are all on a journey of spiritual growth to go ultimately towards Krishna. And we are all at different levels in that journey. And when we are at different levels, why are different people at different levels? It is based on how we have acted in the past. So we have gone through many lifetimes. Just like a cricket match may have multiple innings. So like that, the score that we have right now, it is a result of our previous innings. So when we understand this, the differences that are there in our situations, they are not because of a discrimination on the part of God. They are because of what we have ourselves done in the past. Once we understand this, we see God not as the cause of our problems, we see God as the shelter from our problems. If you think God is causing this, you know, it's not that God is somewhere up there and He's inflicting all these problems on us. No, the problems come as a reaction to what we have done. But God is right here inside us. Sarvasichaham Ridhisanvishto. Krishna says in 15.15 in the Bhagavad Gita, He's right there within our hearts. And He's there to help us deal with whatever situations come in our life. He's not causing the situation. The situations are coming by our own past karma. But He is helping us deal with the situations. And with respect to dealing with the situations, we need to know that God is not just omnipotent, He's also omniscient. Omnipotent means He has great power, He has supreme power. omniscience means he has the supreme wisdom. So sometimes when we want to deal with problems, we have some problem in our life and we go and pray to Krishna, please solve this problem. Please do this, please do that, please do that. Please help me deal with this problem. And we may sincerely pray and the prayer is good. But quite often when we pray, our attitude is, Krishna, you know, I know the solution to the problem, but you execute the solution. So you want a partnership with Krishna where the partnership is my intelligence and your power. So my intelligence and your power. Now this itself, we have faith in Krishna, we at least have faith in Krishna's power, that he can do what I can't do. But we need to have not half faith in Krishna, we have to have full faith in Krishna. Full faith in Krishna means that Krishna is not only more powerful than us, Krishna is also wiser than us. When you understand he is wiser than us, that means he will solve our problems, but often he may not solve them on our terms. And we need to be open to his solutions. So Krishna, please, rather than saying, Krishna, this is the problem and please solve it in this way, can you, Krishna, give me the intelligence how I should act in this situation. Please give me the intelligence to serve you in this situation, whatever the situation is. When we go with that attitude, then rather than seeing the problem, rather than seeing the difficulty as a deprivation, we see it more as an opportunity to see how God Krishna is going to work. How Krishna is going to help us deal with the problems. Most of us know the story of the Akshaya Patra. Now, when Draupadi and the Pandavas were living in the forest, so because of the manipulation of Duryodhana, Durvasa Muni came to the forest at a time after Draupadi had eaten. So the Akshaya Patra would not give any more food after that. And Draupadi was in great anxiety at that time. And now then she did not know what to do. The Pandavas were panicky and she was a devotee. So when she did not know what to do, she knew what to do. What was that? Pray to Krishna. So she really prayed to Krishna. And actually her prayer seemed to have increased her problems. Because as soon as Krishna came, Krishna, Draupadi, I am very hungry. Please give me some food. Draupadi was mortified. It's one thing to not be able to feed when a sage who is coming, that's bad enough. But the Lord is coming to her house and she is not able to feed him. Krishna, she said, you know that there is nothing in my house, that's why I have called you. Please help me, please don't have fun. Said, no, don't worry. You know, I'm hungry, I'll deal with whatever problem you have afterwards. Give me some food. He says, no, there's nothing. He says, go and see. Well, just go and see the Akshaya Patra. She went and saw the Akshaya Patra. Saw there's one morsel of a grain over there. And Krishna said, give it to me. And Krishna took that and he ate that. And just by that, not only was he satisfied, but all the sages also got satisfied. Now here, the stress of the story is often how Krishna, by satisfying Krishna, everyone else is satisfied. That's an important lesson from the story. But there are other lessons also from the story. Another lesson here is that, see, Draupadi, now, how is it that after she had eaten the food, now see this, normally any housewife, if she is keeping her utensils, wash the utensils and keep them carefully. And if somebody has some golden plates or something like that, some very precious plates, now a special plates which you use only for special occasions, that they will keep even more carefully. So how was it that in this particular plate, after Draupadi had eaten, the one morsel of grain was still there? So now it's the point here is that even if Krishna is actually so expert that he can bring good even through our mistakes. So keeping that plate unclean might have also been a mistake, but doesn't matter. Krishna used that to bring out good. You know, it is said God can draw a straight line even through a crooked pen. So when we focus, oh, this pen is crooked, and we focus on that, we get obsessed with that, then we close ourselves to the expertise of God for bringing good out even of that. That's why if we have this attitude, yes, I am a servant, let me serve. Krishna, give me the intelligence how I can serve. we will see that Krishna will work in wonderful ways. The nature of life is that sometimes we may shake an apple tree and a mango may fall. When we shake an apple tree and we expect an apple itself, and then we don't get an apple, we think, oh, there's no apples are falling, what should I do? But we may shake an apple tree, we are shaking the apple tree because we are hungry. But if we let our perception be restricted by our expectation, if we let our perception be restricted by our expectation, that means I'm thinking I should get a mango and I look only for the mango, I don't look for anything. Oh, sorry, I'm looking only for apple and I look only for apple. If I let my perception be restricted by my expectation, then something which is my need that may be fulfilled, but in some way apart from what my expectation is. So my basic need is not for an apple. My basic need is to satisfy my hunger. And a mango may satisfy it well also. So if we are sheltered in Krishna and we understand that Krishna is ultimately in control, then rather than seeing problems as restrictive, as something which deprive us, something which cause trouble to us, you can see them as opportunities where Krishna will demonstrate His omnipotence and His omnibenevolence. Omnibenevolence means He's always our well-wisher. So rather than looking at life from a mentality, oh, I have this problem and I have that problem and I have that problem and I have that problem. So, okay, I have many problems, but over and above these problems, Krishna is there. And if I stay fixed in the service of Krishna, He will help me find the way out of the problems. So the inscrutable will of the Lord is for the good of all living beings. And if we just do that will, He will reveal to us in due course of time. So this is the attitude. Okay, usually whenever any problem comes in our life, our first reaction tends to be negative. One more problem. We may think one more problem, or we may just get depressed, we may get dejected, we may get irritable, whatever it is. But rather than thinking of that, okay, let me think, how can I serve Krishna? Krishna is still in control. Krishna is still in control, and let me think how I can serve Him in this situation. And Krishna, please guide me as to how I can serve. So when we chant Hare Krishna, when we do the japa, that is not just a ritual where we are just uttering some sound. Actually, the chanting of Hare Krishna is in a mood of prayer. Krishna, please engage me in your service. So I was recently in Melbourne, and one devotee told me that I'm afraid of chanting Hare Krishna. Yeah, so why is that? So this Mataji, she said that actually, you know, I already have a lot of service. So if I pray to Krishna, please engage me in the service, He'll give me more service. I can't do more service now. So I explained that actually when we say Krishna, please engage me in your service, it is not that we are asking Krishna for literally for more service. We are asking primarily for a more of a service attitude. We want to become more situated in the attitude of service. Whatever we are doing, if we do it more and more with an attitude of service, the more we will become fixed and focused in what we are doing. So our chanting is a prayer to infuse us more and more with the service attitude. And when we are having that attitude of service, then whatever situation we are in, we can move forward steadily in that situation. And the last is behavior. Now how we act is not determined by our circumstances. Srila Prabhupada, in one of the first initiation lectures after the devotees got initiated, he told the devotees, now you should not lament. No matter what goes wrong in your life, whatever problems come in your life, don't lament. Because now you have entrusted the reins of your chariot to Krishna. You have entrusted the reins of your chariot. Just like for Arjuna, Krishna was a charioteer. You know, the Upanishads tell that our body is also like a chariot. And the soul is the warrior. Soul is the occupant of this chariot of the body. So in this chariot, the soul is the occupant. And any idea who is the charioteer?
Intelligence,
yeah. So in the chariot body metaphor, the horses are the senses. The the mind is the reins. The intelligence is the charioteer. And the soul is the passenger or the warrior in that chariot. Now, when we say that, and what is Prabhupada saying over here? When we start practicing bhakti, when you become committed to the practice of bhakti, we are entrusting the reins of our chariot to Krishna. That means we align our intelligence with Krishna's guidance. We align our intelligence with Krishna's guidance. The Bhagavad Gita ends with Krishna, Arjuna telling Krishna, Karishye Vachanam Tava. In 18.73 he says, I will do your will. So our specific actions that we do, they may vary according to time, place, circumstance. We cannot always act in the same way. That means, whatever circumstance we face, all of us, we are unique individuals. Our circumstances are unique. And the particular, our attitudes, our conditions, we all come from different backgrounds. And there is no one, in terms of specifics, there is no one standard way in which everyone can respond. In different situations, we may have to respond in different ways. So, how we need to specifically respond, if we have that attitude of service, if we think with calmness, Krishna will give us the intelligence. And we have within us the stockpile of wisdom. We just need to access that. And the process of bhakti enables us to align with that inner reservoir of wisdom that is there within us. Now, bhakti is not so much a practicing bhakti. Sometimes people think, oh, Bhagavad Gita was spoken 5,000 years ago. How is it relevant today? You know, we live in the modern times. Some people say, they're not in modern times, they're postmodern times now. So whatever it is, something that was spoken thousands of years ago, how is it relevant today? You know, practicing bhakti is not about turning back the clock. Practicing bhakti is about turning on the compass. There is a compass within which guides us about how we should act. Just like a person when they are on a ship in an ocean, the compass tells them this is the direction we should go. So like that, within us there is the compass. The compass of inner wisdom. The wisdom that comes from our connection with Krishna. And bhakti is about turning on that compass. And once we start practicing bhakti, once we start making Krishna our default home, once we start looking at life in terms of how Krishna, every situation is an opportunity to serve, then that inner compass will guide us. Okay, in this situation, you act like this. In this situation, you act like this. And then, we will be able to act in ways that are actually constructive, that enable us to grow rather than get choked. The Bhagavad Gita is a historical book. There was a war that happened 5,000 years ago. I've heard the Bhagavad Gita was spoken. The Bhagavad Gita, in addition to being historical, is also symbolic. Arjuna's Gandiva bow, it represents our determination. At the start of the Bhagavad Gita, in 1.46, the last verse of the first chapter, Arjuna puts aside his bow. Visrujya sasaram chapam shoka samvigna manasaha. So he just puts aside his bow because he's afflicted by misery. But by the end of the Bhagavad Gita, in 18.78, the last verses, Yatra Yogeshwara Krishna, Yatra Partho Dhanurdhara, Tatra Shreer Vijayo Bhutir, Dhruvani Tirma Tirmama. So it is said that by the end of the Bhagavad Gita, what has happened? Yatra Partho Dhanurdhara. Partha Arjuna is Dhanurdhara. He is described as Dhanurdhara because the same bow which he had put down, now he has picked it up and he is ready to fight. So like that Arjuna's bow, it represents our determination. Sometimes when we go through life and there are so many complexities, there are so many perplexities, there are so many adversities that we may face, we just get disheartened, you know. I don't feel like doing anything, I can just give up. But when we hear the message of the Bhagavad Gita, when we hear about God's enduring love for us, when we understand how our own nature essentially is spiritual, and beyond whatever is happening at the material level, ultimately, every situation is an opportunity for our spiritual growth. Then, by understanding this wisdom, our determination gets restored. And with that restored determination, we can act confidently in whatever situation we may face in our life. And by acting thus, going to summarize quickly today's class, by creating for ourselves a positive home for our thoughts, which we all have some home, but when we practice bhakti and purify ourselves, we make Krishna the home for our thoughts. Then much of the mental energy that gets wasted in negativity, in resentment, that mental energy gets conserved and it can be channeled. So by cultivating a positive home for our thoughts, a devotional home for our thoughts, by developing a devotional attitude towards the ups and downs of life, that means rather than seeing, oh, this problem, that problem, we see that Krishna is always in control. And every situation, rather than thinking of it a problem, we can see it as an opportunity to go deeper into our relationship with Krishna. Krishna, how can I serve you? So Krishna is always our well-wisher. The problems come not because Krishna has sent the problems to us. The problems are coming because of our past karma. But Krishna is there to help us deal with the problems. And by putting faith, the attitude also means that rather than thinking of demanding solution in our terms, we ask not only for Krishna's power to help us, we also ask for Krishna's intelligence to help us to understand how to act. Instead of saying, why me? We ask, how now? And then when we have this spiritual home for our thoughts, we have this devotionally faithful attitude, then our inner compass will become activated. And whatever situation we are in, we will get guided from within to act in a way by which we can make a positive destiny for ourselves. Yesterday I talked about how what we are is God's gift to us. What we become is our gift to God. It means whatever talents we have been given, whatever abilities we have been given, they're all meant to be used in a positive service. The Bhagavad Gita gives the example in 11th chapter, 28 and 29 verses. It says, gives two examples. One is of how a moth moves into the fire and gets burned, and how a river moves towards the ocean. And this is talking about the journey of life of those who are godless and those who are godly. So the point is, everybody has to go through life. Ultimately, everybody will grow old. Everybody will die. But the acharyas explain that when a moth moves towards the fire, the moth's destruction is self-impelled. The moth doesn't have to move towards the fire. And a moth's going towards the fire, it doesn't do any good to anyone. Simply the moth gets burnt. But when the river moves towards the ocean, the river's essential nature is not changed. The river is water and it is going towards water. So like that, those who live spiritually, they are living spiritually now, and even when there is deterioration of the body because of old age, there is disease, there is death, still they will continue to live spiritually. And when a river is moving towards the ocean, while moving towards the ocean, the river actually irrigates the land close by. And the river leads to the growth of lush vegetation all around it. So like that, devotees, when they go through their life journey, just by their moving in their life journey, they are making positive contributions. Those who are around them, they are actually enabling them to become more positive, to grow, to develop. So we are all meant for the supreme destination ultimately when we practice bhakti, but we are also meant for positive contribution while we are living in this world. And this way bhakti brings about auspiciousness in our life, in this life as well as thereafter. Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Hare Krishna. Yeah. Where is the mic? Okay. Do we have a mic? Okay. Yesterday I was asked a question. I would like to answer that till. But the mic is going somewhere? Till then I will answer. The first lecture was titled that Daiva is greater, Daiva is not just destiny. So I did not go into that. What is the difference between Daiva and destiny? So yeah, I did not go into, because it's slightly technical. The word destiny in English basically refers to the idea that there are things which are beyond our control and they're just going to happen to us. But when the Bhagavatam uses the Bhakti tradition uses the word Daiva, it refers not so much to some unknown, unpredictable, arbitrary force which is going to bring some suffering upon us or bring something happening upon us. We understand that Daiva is something we ourselves create. That our Daiva is the aggregate of our own past karma's reactions which are coming upon us according to a particular plan. So Daiva is a much more philosophically precise concept than the vagueness that is associated with the word of destiny. So in that sense, Daiva is more than destiny. It's not just some... yes, there is some factors beyond our control which do shape our life. But those factors are not malevolent. Those factors are not unknown. Those factors are something which we only have contributed and created. Okay? Yes. Who has a question? Okay, you can speak. I'll repeat the question. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. 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 So if we are conditioned in a particular way, either by our upbringing or by our genes, then they prompt us to act in particular ways. So how do they only shape our behavior and not determine our behavior? Yeah. Our conditioning from whatever source it comes before us, it dangles certain courses of action which seem to be like natural responses for us. At the same time, what seems natural is not always essential or desirable. So for example, say in the past, there have been a lot of discrimination. Say, for example, people who were whites in America, they used to look at people who were African Americans, these are low class people. Or say, because of the theory of social Darwinism was the idea that the Darwinian survival of the fittest doctrine was applied to different races. And social Darwinism was the idea that some races are good and some races are bad. And Hitler took that idea and he said the Aryans, whom we consider the Germans, he said they are the best race and the Jews are the worst race. So now, with this idea, he said that actually, because the Jews are the worst race, so the Jews are going to be annihilated by nature. Because only the fit are going to survive, the unfit are going to die. And he said, his idea was that when we are killing the Jews, we are in the gas chambers, we are helping nature accelerate its course of progress. So that was his idea, and actually he brainwashed, practically speaking, the whole nation at that time. So now, can we say, now during the Nuremberg trials, at that time, many of the Nuremberg trials were the trials when many of the generals of Nazi Germany, they were tried. So the many of the generals at that time said that we were simply following orders. That's what our bosses told us to do, and that's why we arrested and we killed the Jews. So the point is that we all have a basic sense of conscience. We all have our intelligence. And just because in the name of following orders of some authority, we cannot act in barbaric or brutal ways. So the point here is that certain circumstances, so for them at that time, it may well seem natural. Okay, somebody is a Jew, tell about them, get them arrested and kill them. But then they have their conscience and they should have chosen not to act that way. So just as we can easily understand that even if there's an atmosphere of hatred against a particular community, we are not bound to hate that community. We have a choice to act more objectively. So just as there is a social environment which may push us towards certain perceptions, but it doesn't force us to act according to those perceptions. So just as there's what social environment does, similarly, our mental environment also. Now, we may have a perception of some people to be like this, or some problems to be like this, or whatever. But we are different from our mind. And our mind may push us to act in particular ways. But we can counter push. So for example, say, if somebody is studying for an exam. And if the exam is 6 months away and they say, oh, today is a cricket match. Maybe I'll just go and watch the cricket match. And they say, yes. If the exam is 6 months away, you say, okay, let me watch the cricket match. But if the exam is tomorrow, the same impulse is coming. Let me watch the cricket match. But, you know, somebody, when the exam is tomorrow and they watch the cricket match, you know, the other will chastise them. You could have watched the cricket match later. You shouldn't watch. You should study now. And they will themselves agree. So the point is that we ourselves see there are situations when impulses come and we have the capacity to say no to the impulses. So that by the way we have acted, the extent to which we can say no or say yes, that may vary. So for example, say if we are short-tempered, then when somebody irritates us, we tend to become angry. So now what may happen is that we may not, it will be, if somebody irritates us, it may be difficult for us to avoid the emotion of anger. But we can avoid expressing that anger immediately. So for example, what I do is when somebody acts in a way that really makes me wild. So I cannot just wish away the anger. The anger is there. But if I express it, I know I will speak in ways that will hurt that person unnecessarily and I will not be able to make the proper points which I want to make. On the other hand, if I don't speak it also, then I am repressing myself. And actually, I am not really improving the situation also because they may keep repeating that situation. So sometimes what I do is I just write a mail expressing my full anger. But then I make a rule, I will not send that mail. So for at least 24 hours, I just keep it there as it is. And then after 24 hours, then I read the mail. Hey, this is too heavy. You know, I shouldn't have spoken like this. And then I say, yeah, this is a reasonable point, but maybe I can rephrase this a little bit. Sometimes I may not send the mail at all. Sometimes I may edit the mail a lot and send some part of it and keep the other part as it is. Or sometimes, on very few occasions, particularly never I would say, I send the mail as it is. Because, so that time, I need to express myself. But others don't need to hear my expression. So, based on our conditioning, whichever the conditioning may be, we have to find out some way in, we cannot choke the emotion that is there. But just because we can't choke the emotion, doesn't mean that we have to, in an unregulated way, express it. So, to find some way in which, when a particular course of action seems to be the natural course of action for us, at that time, we may not be able to say no to it. And trying to say no to it may appear like repression. But instead of no, we can have a pause button. This pause. Okay, I feel like doing this, but not immediately. So, journaling, writing a letter like this is basically journaling. You know, in a journal, we express our emotions and we give vent to them. And then once we get those thoughts and emotions outside us, then that creates a certain level of objectivity. Because once they are inside, as long as they are inside us, they are just creating congestion inside. They are not allowing us to think in any new way. This, the mind is going along the same old tired tracks again and again and again. But once we get it out, there is a certain release that is created. And afterwards, when we read it after some time, there is some objectivity. So how exactly, when we are prompted to act in particular ways, how we can check that we will have to use our own creativity to find out how to do that. But there is what the mind, what our conditioning does is, it presents us certain options. But just to give an example, just if there's a multiple choice paper, you know, in the multiple choice exam, we don't think necessarily that the first choice is going to be the right choice, isn't it? Yes, sometimes the first choice will be the right choice, but the rightness of the choice, the rightness of the option is not determined by its position. It is determined by its content. So if we are just in a two-tiering hurry, just if A for all of them, you know, we may get F because of that. So, like that, by our conditionings, the first option that comes, we tend to act on that first option itself. But by creating some kind of pause button for ourselves, we can make sure, okay, the first option has come, but the first option may not necessarily be the best option. So our conditionings present the first option as a very natural or alluring option for us. But by finding out how we can create a pause button for ourselves, we can avoid acting on that option, and then eventually we can choose how to act. So the mind, which is the way through which most of our conditionings come upon us, the mind can impel. It can't compel. Impel means to push, whereas compel means to force. So So when the mind pushes, we can resist, we can counter push. So it doesn't compel us, it doesn't take away our free will. And the more we choose to counter push, the greater our free will becomes, more and more active. And then we can make healthier choices. Does it answer your question? Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Mataji. Okay. Can any food or any medicine change our destiny? See, here, again, what we mean by destiny is important to understand. See, it's if we consider destiny as something which is absolutely fixed and unchangeable, destiny is not necessarily like that. There is certain stockpile of karmic reaction that we are meant to get, and those are going to come upon us. But the food, the medicine that we take, taking that is also a part of our duty. We have been given a particular body, and taking care of the body is my responsibility. Suppose it's a very cold night, and on a cold night I take 6 ice creams, and then when the next morning when I wake up, ice cream, I start feeling, and somebody says, you know, what happened? Well, it's my destiny.
Well,
it's not your destiny. Yeah. It's not your destiny. It's just your stupidity, actually. It's my stupidity. Why did I have to eat 6 ice creams? So we have, if we don't eat properly, if we don't take proper medicines, then we are actually acting in irresponsible ways, and they will have consequences. So it's not that everything that happens to us is only because of past karma. Now our present choices also affect. You know, so if I am overeating now, or if I am taking cold food on a cold night, the reaction will come immediately. So our present choices will also bring consequences. And by making the present choices wisely, we can avoid unnecessary adverse consequences. That's the first point. So by eating and taking medicines properly, we can avoid aggravating our destiny. Beyond that, just as there is preparation. So when we talk about destiny, we could talk about destiny more in terms of like a weather forecast, as I mentioned in the first class. The destiny tells us basically what kind of environment we are going to get in our life. Now, how we prepare for that environment is up to us. So for example, if I understand that I have a sickly body, I need to regulate my diet. And then I act to regulate my diet properly. And that itself will also help me to avoid unnecessary complications. But if we, whatever food we have, if we offer it to take Krishna and take Krishna Prasad, that also helps us to minimize the reactions to karma. But with respect to our destiny, the important point is, rather than thinking in terms of something, it's not like not a matter of skill or trickery. If there's some magic formula which I do, then I'll escape my destiny. No, there is one culinary way of rephrasing the law of karma is, the normalcy law of karma is, whatever action we do, that reaction we are going to get. So if you want to phrase this in kitchen terms, now what you cook, you will have to eat. Jo pakaya hai, wo pachana padega. So what we have done, we will get the reactions for that. So we cannot be able to escape the reactions. But what happens by the practice of bhakti is that those reactions don't trouble us so much. So for example, if I am going to get some sickness, if I am very much caught in bodily consciousness, then when the sickness comes, I feel it will be the end of the world for me. But if I understand that actually I am a spiritual being, and I can spiritually connect with Krishna, whatever my situation is, then even if I face difficulties, even if I face a sickness, well, I can remember Krishna and I can minimize the misery that comes. So there is an external troubling stimuli that is there, and there is an internal trouble that I experience. So the external troubling stimuli may come, whatever happens, but the internal trouble that we experience, that can be minimized if we take shelter of Krishna. So, taking seeing our body as a vehicle given by Krishna to us, and taking food, taking medicines properly to take care of this body, not just in a mood of avoiding some future complications, but in the mood of service to Krishna, in the mood of taking care of the instrument that Krishna has given to us, that is the best way we can prepare ourselves for whatever destiny will give us in future. Does that answer your question? Thank you, Maharaji. Yes, Maharaji. Yeah, we'll come to you. Yeah. You can speak loudly here.
Hare Krishna, Prabhuji.
Yeah.
Nowadays, all the teenagers, they always ask for freedom. We want this freedom, that freedom. So, without a spiritual background, how can we advise these children?
Okay. So, when youngsters, they say, I want to be free to do this, free to do that. So, how can we explain to them if they don't have a spiritual background? Yes, freedom is a natural desire of the heart. At the same time, we need to recognize that there are two kinds of freedom. There is freedom for and there is freedom from. For example, so freedom for means, hey, I want to eat this, I want to eat that, I want to eat that. I want to be free to eat whatever I want, whenever I want. That's freedom for. But there is another kind of freedom, that is freedom from. So for example, if somebody... So if I focus only as, if I define freedom only in terms of freedom for, I want to eat whatever I want, whenever I want. Quite often the result of this is I get addicted to certain kinds of food. And then if I'm addicted to, say, unhealthy foods, then every time, every few minutes, you know, my mind goes back to food. My mind goes back to food. And then that is actually not freedom. That is bondage. So when we get, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita 16.11, Asha Pasha Shatair Baddha Kama Krodha Parayana. He says, Asha, desire is like a bond. It's, desire can become a bond which drags us in particular direction, like a noose. So when we focus on freedom only in terms of freedom for, hey, okay, I want to eat this, I want to do that, I want to enjoy this, I want to go there, whatever, then often those indulgences become like ropes. And then they drag us towards those indulgences again and again and again.
So for example, say if this is the home, this is the hostel of a student and this is the school. And say in between there is a bar where the student can go and say maybe take some alcohol. Now what happens if there are two students? One has never drunk alcohol and decided that, you know, my parents have told, my elders have told, I have seen what all happens. I'm not going to drink alcohol. That person just passes by there and doesn't even think about the alcohol. But the other person, every time this second person passes by that alcohol bar thing, maybe I can go and drink. Maybe I can take a drink. And then, initially when they see the alcohol bar, then the desire comes, I can drink. But after some time, if they keep drinking, then as soon as they come out of the house, at that time, immediately the desire is there. Hey, maybe I can go and drink. Sometimes, not only, there are some alcoholics, they're so much bound, that as soon as they wake up, the first thing that they think is, oh, I have to drink. So I am currently writing a book on addiction and de-addiction and bhakti. So I was reading about how people become addicted. So there was this one young man in America, and he one night, one early morning, you know, he slept at around 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, and 3 o'clock he woke up and he felt a strong urge to drink. He went to his fridge and he found there was no alcohol over there. He said, I'll go to the nearest bar. And he was going towards the bar, and while he was going in his car broke down. It was cold night, North America, you know, Detroit, that part in the winter is freezing. So he went there, he walked through the cold night, and as soon as he came to the bar, he found a particular brand he wanted to drink, that was not there. He got exasperated, and he had to walk almost like several blocks to another place where there was a bar. Finally he went there, and then finally he got the bar. And the craving was so intolerable. Immediately opened up it and drank it. He says, no, I drank a little bit of gulp. Then he thought, no, I spent so much. I'll drink this very peacefully, very joyfully. I'll enjoy this. So he closed it and started walking along. And as walking along, and he slipped and fell. And he had not closed the lid. So there's an abhishek of alcohol for him. as he was lying on the ground, and suddenly he looked at all the buildings, all of them, like skyscraper buildings, with all their houses, you know, everybody was dark, everybody was sleeping. And then suddenly it struck him, what am I doing? So I could have been peacefully sleeping in my bed. Here am I at night in cold, you know, lying on this ground, injured with alcohol all over my body. That time he said that like, I am a slave. So that time they realized, I am a slave. So when we start indulging, we may think that I am enjoying, but every time I enjoy, the desire becomes a stronger and stronger bond for me. And then I cannot get rid of the desire. So, if we think of freedom only in terms of freedom for, then we become bound. And if we can realize that we are bound, that also is a fortune. But now our freedom is lost most when we have the illusion of freedom. Now, when I think I am free, but actually I have an illusion of freedom. So when I have the illusion of freedom, then, so today most of the things that we think in terms of freedom, you know, what are those things? Okay, I want to eat this, I want to go here, I want to watch this movie, I want to do this, I want to do that. But often if we think about these desires, these are not really the desires that come from our heart. The desires that are induced within us by the corporate control media. You know, this is something which is quite insidious. In the 1920s, 1929 roughly, the cigarette industry, they found that their market had reached more or less saturation in America. Because they found that, you know, all the young people, all the young men who could smoke, who had money enough to buy cigarettes, they were already buying cigarettes. And at that time, the harmful effects of smoking had not yet come out. So they thought, how do we expand our markets? And they got... Their marketing team got a brainwave. They said 50% of the population doesn't smoke. Because at that time women were not smoking. So then in the American Independence Day parade, they had some of the leading female icons of America, Bollywood stars and other prominent social female icons. They had custom made cigarettes for them, and at the most visible points in that parade, they had all of them flip out a cigarette, a special customized, you know, female, thin, long cigarette, which females, and they all started smoking it. Yeah, it was, the reporter just, media just flipped out, what are you doing? And they marketed that cigarette as, oh, we are lighting the torch of freedom. Now, because that was a time when the suffragette movement was gaining power, and the idea was that women had been exploited and restricted for long, said, oh, we all want to light the torch of freedom. And within just a few years, millions of women practically started smoking. And it was only later that the harmful effects of smoking for women, especially for women in their pregnancy, all that started coming up. But by that time, it was too late. So when the hysteria that was created, oh, torches of freedom. Now, nobody asked at that time, how does lighting a cigarette lead to freedom? You know, the perception is so strong, and the media wants to create a particular perception in order to exploit us. They define freedom particular ways. So we have to honestly and intelligently think. Now, is what I think that I want to do, this is what I want to do, and I'm being restricted. There is freedom, what we think of as freedom for, quite often that is defined by the corporate control media for us. So we should also think of freedom in terms of freedom from. If I have freedom from certain desires, that itself is a great relief. So I was telling the example of that person, this student who has never drunk alcohol and has no intention of drinking alcohol. They just pass by the bar without any temptation at all. Their mind and mental energy is not agitated at all. So freedom from is actually a very empowering form of freedom. So if every time I think, you know, every time I pass by a hotel, I want to eat something. Every time I go here, I want to eat something. Then that is not freedom. That is actually a sickening form of bondage where I just can't think about higher things. Because I'm constantly thinking of eating, I'm thinking of this, I'm thinking of that. So we have to not let the world and the culture define what is freedom for us. When we look inwards, when we look upward. Upward means towards the scripture, towards spirituality, and we realize, understand what our values are, what is truly important for us, and then focus on that. Then we will be acting in a, acting for, see, freedom is itself not the ultimate goal. Freedom is meant to be a tool for happiness. Freedom alone, we want freedom so that we can pursue happiness. But an alcoholic who has freedom, now their freedom is hurting them. Many times when people become addicts, they go into rehabilitation clinics. And one of the fundamental characters of a rehabilitation clinic is, if somebody is going for a rehabilitation from alcoholism, then they are put in an environment where they have no alcohol over there. They voluntarily put themselves over there because they recognize that the freedom to drink will mean destruction for me, will mean bondage for me. So just as they voluntarily put themselves in a situation of regulation. So similarly, we need to recognize that freedom doesn't come simply by doing what we want to do, where we want to do, when we want to do. But freedom comes by understanding what is truly important for us and then developing the focus to do those things. So the person who is thinking, I want to be free to drink whenever I want, that person will not be able to act in constructive ways for developing their higher talents, for pursuing their higher purposes. So rather than letting the corporate control media define freedom and freedom in terms of only for freedom to do this, freedom to do that, we can actually have an expanded definition of freedom where freedom from certain drives and cravings is also empowering. So that we have freedom for doing higher and nobler things in our life. So the rules don't necessarily bind us. Rules often free us to do higher things. Rules, they free us from lower cravings so that we can do higher things in our life. So freedom is not simply uninhibited. Freedom is not simply indiscriminate self-expression. Freedom, whatever I want to do, I'll do it. That is not freedom. Freedom is like, freedom means the facility to bring out the best within us. You know, suppose there is a music competition and people say that I want to be free to play whatever I want to play, and somebody never does any practice and just goes on the stage and is free to play what they want to play. Well, they will be expressing themselves, but often that expression will be not the best of themselves, it will be the worst of themselves. So if we want to express ourselves, we want to express the best of ourselves, then that requires that the musicians practice. They practice systematically. Those who are aspiring music artists, they practice and then they bring out the best. So we shouldn't see, define freedom in a simplistic way as doing whatever we want to do, whenever we want to do. We need to see freedom as some that facility which brings out the best within us. And that freedom comes by practicing spirituality, which involves certain rules, which frees us from our lower drives, so that our higher aspirations can be expressed. Does it answer your question? Thank you. Yes.
Hare Krishna Prabhuji. In Bhagavad Gita, Karma Yoga, Bhakti Yoga and Jnana Yoga are mentioned. How one should take up in life for pursuing these yogas? Are they based on individual constitution or personalities? Like intellectual taking up Jnana Yoga, or emotional taking up Karma Yoga, and all three lead to Moksha, and I believe, can you throw some light on this?
So yes, in the Bhagavad Gita, Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, all are talked about. So are these meant for people with different kinds of mentalities? Is it that more sentimental people take up Bhakti and more intellectual people take up Jnana? And do all lead to moksha? Yes, all the yogas are progressive paths towards liberation. So the word yoga itself means connection. Connection of the soul with the supreme. So karma yoga means connection primarily through action. Detached action. Jnana yoga means connection primarily through intellect. Primarily through intellection. Intellection means intellectual contemplation. And Bhakti Yoga is connection through devotion. Now, if you look at the Bhagavad Gita, it does talk about different paths. But one conception in the Gita is that the Bhagavad Gita says, okay, whichever path you want to follow, you can follow. If you want to follow this, you can follow that. But if we see the Bhagavad Gita, it concludes the very categorical declaration. 18.66 says, Sarva dharman parityajya mamekam sharanam vraja aham tvam sarva papebhyo mokshayishyami mashuchah. Sarva dharman parityajya mamekam sharanam vraja. You have all varieties of religion and just surrender to me. The surrender to me is clearly the path of bhakti. So Krishna is not just telling over here, you path, follow whatever path you want. Krishna is recommending that you follow bhakti. And a bhakti can also be followed at various levels. So for example, in from 12.8 to 12.12, Krishna talks about how bhakti can be followed at various levels. First he says, mai eva mana dhatsva mai buddhim niveshaya nivasishyasi mai eva ta urdhvam na samshayaha. He says, fix your mind on me, devote your intelligence to me, and in this way you will live in me even now. So it's interesting, Krishna is also saying, devote your intelligence to me. He's not saying that if you are an intellectual, you practice Jnana Yoga. No, he's saying, even if you have intelligence, devote your intelligence to me. Then he says, if you cannot constantly devote your mind and intelligence to me, that's 12.8. He says, one level lower is 12.9. Atachittam samadhatum nashaknosi maistiram abhyasa yogena tato mamichaptam dhananjaya. He says, you practice abhyasa yoga. Abhyasa yoga means practice trying to fix the mind on me. Do sadhana bhakti. So for example, when we chant Hare Krishna and try to fix the mind on Krishna, that is what we are trying to do, sadhana bhakti. Then if you can't even do that, then he says one level lower is you work for me. Matkarmo paramabho madartham pikarmani kurvan siddhim avapsisi. He says you work for me. That means do various kinds of seva. Even if you can't think about Krishna, we can do various kinds of seva for Krishna. If you can't do various kinds of seva, then Krishna says you work but you sacrifice the fruits of your action for some noble cause. And by that you will gradually rise to a higher level of perfection. So the point is, Krishna clearly recommends Bhakti Yoga as the universal path for liberation for everyone. And if somebody cannot practice Bhakti at the highest level, they can practice Bhakti at various levels, where sometimes the intelligence is prominent or where the action is prominent. So rather than thinking of the Bhagavad Gita as recommending different paths in different sections, some people say that, say the first six chapters of the Bhagavad Gita talk about Karma Yoga, the last six chapters talk about Jnana Yoga, the middle six chapters talk about Bhakti Yoga. That's what is often understood. But more precisely, actually the first six chapters of the Bhagavad Gita talk about how Karma Yoga leads to Bhakti Yoga. And the last six chapters talk about how Jnana Yoga leads to Bhakti Yoga. So for example, Krishna, in the third chapter, 30th verse, he says that Mai sarvani karmani sannyasya adhyatma chetasa nirashir nirmamo bhutva yudhya samayam tajvara. Third chapter is called as Karma Yoga. But this chapter, this verse is like the climax in that. He says, don't just be detached from the fruits of your work. He says, offer the fruits of your work to me. So Karma Yoga culminates in Bhakti Yoga. What Krishna is telling is, practice Karma Yoga, but just don't focus on karma. Don't just focus on detachment from karma. Focus on devoting your fruits to me. Similarly, when he talks about Jnana Yoga, in 7.19 he states, Bahunam janmana amante jnanavan mam prapadyate vasudeva sarvamiti samahatma sudurlabha. So he says, Bahunam janmanamante. After many lifetimes, those who become jnanavan, those who become truly knowledgeable, what do? They mam prapadyate. They surrender to me. So that means the perfection of Jnana Yoga is also to practice bhakti. So the Bhagavad Gita talks about, yes, people who have a primarily action orientation, they can practice karma. Those who have primarily intellectual orientation, they can practice Jnana Yoga. But the Bhagavad Gita's recommendation is, the best course of action is to practice Bhakti Yoga. And within Bhakti Yoga, one may focus more on action, or one may focus more on intellection. That may vary according to one's own nature. But all paths lead to progressive elevation. But the easiest and the fastest elevation comes by the practice of Bhakti. And all other paths, to lead to the ultimate success, they have to culminate in Bhakti. So the Bhagavad Gita's recommendation is, yes, different people with different mentalities can follow different paths, but eventually they have to come to bhakti, and they may practice bhakti according to their individual natures. They may focus on different levels with different faculties being more stressed, and ultimately through bhakti they will attain perfection. Does it answer your question? Thank you. Hare Krishna. Yes, Prabhu. You can speak, I'll repeat.
Speak, I'll repeat loud. Hare Krishna. Yeah. So Roji, there are three things that come to my mind when I have to make a decision. One is the knowledge that I have gained to discriminate, right? And the second thing is the default comfort zone that I have to live in, so I have to justify what I concluded on previously. I have concluded on several things and I want to justify every time that, you know, my conclusions are right. So it gives me the comfort zone. So one is the knowledge to discriminate. Second is the justifications to live in a comfort zone. And the third thing is to depend freely on as a will of God. Right? Something when it happens in life. This makes it very complicated to, you know, face a situation. For example, you know, say I'm giving a seminar and a hippie enters the room and sits there. Now, my discrimination of knowledge says he is going to do something cranky. Because I am only looking into the externals. I don't know his internal. Right? My justification of my philosophy says he will definitely do something because, you know, there are so many examples and there is a conclusion. Right? But depending on will of God says, maybe he has come here to teach me a lesson. How should we deal with this contradicting situation?
Okay. So the question is that sometimes, you know, we, through our experience of life, we develop particular modes of perception which enable us to deal with situations in a sort of some level of control and predictability we get in situations. So we tend to pursue things in a particular way. But how do we depend on Krishna? Do we focus on maintaining our perceptions, or do we focus on just depending on Krishna in everything and being completely open to whatever happens? Both are valid. See, the standard depiction of surrender to Krishna is Draupadi raising her hands and just calling out to Krishna. So that is definitely one way of surrender. But the Bhagavad Gita concludes by telling Arjuna, surrender to me. Saradharman pratyajamamekam sharanam raja. And the Bhagavad Gita, this is the Krishna's instructions end over here. But the Bhagavad Gita itself ends with, not with Arjuna with raising his hand in surrender. The Bhagavad Gita ends with Arjuna raising his bow in readiness to fight, and that is also surrender. So surrender doesn't necessarily mean passivity. Surrender can also mean activity, not just activity, being proactive, being resourceful. So the way we surrender in different situations may be different, and a certain level of preparedness is important. And whatever resources we have, whether they be intellectual resources or they be in terms of experience, in terms of certain skills, we do need to use all those resources in our service of Krishna. So for example, if you are going to a particular place where people are of a particular mindset, say if you are going to a place where people, if you are going to science college or where there are PhD science students who are coming, then we need to have some preparation, if possible, in the kind of scientific thinking which they have and some knowledge. So the resources that we have, that's good. And we can use them. But sometimes we may go to a particular situation, certain preparation, but things may come outside that box also. So that means that we have a tendency to analyze, and analyze means we fit people into certain categories. And that analytical ability enables us to make sense of life to a large extent. And that analytical ability we should use. But at the same time, as devotees, we want to take shelter of Krishna, and our intelligence should be a tool for us to take shelter of Krishna. Our intelligence itself should not become our shelter. You getting this point? Krishna is here and my intelligence, it helps me to act wisely. So what I should do is, I should use my intelligence to act wisely in Krishna's service. So if I am an intellectual, naturally I cannot stop being an intellectual. So I may analyze, and I should use my analytical skills. But my intelligence should help me to take better shelter of Krishna, and to help share that shelter of Krishna with others. But sometimes, whatever is our greatest strength can become our greatest weakness. Because that, instead of becoming a tool to take shelter of Krishna, that becomes an alternative to Krishna. So when that happens, so then I have a particular framework of thinking, and that is helpful for me. But if my thinking and my perceiving stops only with that, then it is becoming a restriction. So I should see my analytical framework as a gift from Krishna to be used in his service. But sometimes it's a tool. Sometimes Krishna may bring a situation where it may not fit into my analytical framework. At that time, we need to be open. Krishna, I can't make sense of this. Please tell me how I can serve you. Prabhupada in the Markandeya Bhagavata Dharma says that Ache kichu karje tabe ei anumane nahi keno anibena ei yugasthane. He says, Krishna, I guess, Anuman, he says, I guess you must have brought me here to America for some purpose. I don't know what purpose you brought me for, but you must have brought me for some purpose. So even Prabhupada, it's not that when he went to America, everything was clear. Okay, I'll go here, I'll meet this person, I'll go here, and that person will become a devotee. No, he was, it's more of a strategy. You try out one thing, if it works, you don't go. It doesn't work, you try out something else. So we do use the strategies that have worked for us, but at the same time, we recognize that they are strategies. They are not ironclad, unchangeable principles. A particular frame of analysis helps me, I'll use it. But if it does, if things don't make sense according to that frame of analysis, I should be open. So we don't. So openness to Krishna means using what resources we have in his service, but also keeping on serving Krishna even when those resources don't work. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Hare
Krishna. How to control revengeful, violent thoughts?
Yeah. So how to control revengeful, violent thoughts? There are multiple courses of action. The firstly is that if somebody has hurt us, it's natural to, but the feelings of hurt, we have to acknowledge that they're natural. So to deny them, to repress them, that is not desirable. Because if somebody has hurt us, to just think that I've not been hurt, it's like I've been wounded and I say I'm not wounded. It's not going to work. The wound is going to stay there and it's going to worsen. So if we have been hurt, we do need to acknowledge that we've been hurt. But then, how do I act? Now, if I'm walking along a road and if a snake has bitten me, then what do I need to do? You know, I need to go to a doctor. But if I, how dare this snake bite me? I'm going to go and beat it. And I chase after the snake. Well, in chasing after the snake, the poison is going faster. You know, I'm accelerating my blood pressure, accelerating my heartbeat, and I'll be poisoning myself more. So, if the snake bite is there, that hurt is there, we have to acknowledge the hurt, but we have to act in a proper way. Now, it is not, if somebody has hurt us, what all are the options for us? It's not that just because we are being spiritual, that means any and every wrong has to be always forgiven. So there is forgiveness as an emotion, and there is forgiveness as an action. The two are different things. As devotees, as not just as devotees, but as intelligent human beings, forgiveness as an emotion is always desirable. That means that as if that person did like this and I will do like this to them, when we have that hateful, revengeful mentality, that hurts us more than it hurts others. Because it's like I'm holding a burning piece of coal in my hand, waiting for my enemy so that I will hurl at that enemy. But before that enemy comes, that coal is going to burn me so much. So, if somebody has hurt us, first of all, we acknowledge the hurt. But after that, rather than letting that revengeful mentality eat us up, we can understand, okay, you know, I forgive you. When we say forgiving, it does not necessarily mean that we let them go scot-free. It simply means that we don't let revenge be the driving motive for action. You hurt me, so I'll hurt you. Rather than operating at that level, Prabhupada says, don't be angry at the instrument of your karma. If somebody has hurt me, ultimately I must have done something wrong in my previous life, because of which the karmic reaction, they are hurting me. So then when we have that attitude, we can cultivate forgiveness as an emotion. Forgiveness as an emotion means, it's not the same as forgiveness as action. It basically means, we don't have the vindictive, revengeful attitude while responding to that person. Now, what are the options for us? See, usually we tend to equate forgiveness with trust. Actually, I have a whole seminar on forgiveness and trust, or basically forgiving. I just mentioned this very briefly. Forgiveness and trust are not the same. Forgiveness is for the past. Trust is for the future. Forgiveness can be given, but trust has to be earned. If somebody has hurt us in the past, we may forgive them for that hurt. But that does not mean that we open them to hurt us again and again. So we may have to create a safe distance between us and them so that they don't hurt us again. And we, if they are to come in closer to us, then they have to earn that trust. That means if somebody has hurt us, then rather than acting based on the mentality of revenge, we forgive them as an emotion. Okay, it's because of my own karma. But that does not mean that I will let them hurt me again and again. So what are the options for us? Now, one option is that we forgive them as an emotion, but if we find that their mentality, they are not ready to change at all. They are just going on doing the same thing again and again. Today they did it with me. If I give the opportunity, they'll again do the same thing again with me. They'll do it with somebody else. They'll do it with somebody else. They're going to hurt others. Then in such a situation, we may have to take action to correct. So whatever action that may vary according to the situation. You know, whether it's just like there is a distance in the relationship or there's some kind of judicial intervention, or that will vary. But if we find that the person has no intention or inclination to change, then there may have to take corrective action for that. Then other is, in between, you know, we communicate in a manner. That is like one extreme solution where we have to counter that problem, but not with the motive of hurting them. The motive is more of making sure that they don't hurt others. So that is not a self-centered motive. That is more of a selfless motive. Because when they are going to hurt others, they are going to create bad karma for themselves, and they are going to hurt others. It's going to create problems for everyone. So it may be part of our responsibility to correct that. But before, so it is one extreme solution. The usual standard is, you know, we communicate in an appropriate way to them how much their actions have hurt us. And this we should do in a non-judgmental way. Non-judgmental way means, no, you are such a monster. Once I start saying like that, as soon as we make a judgment about a person, their ego goes into the defensive. And they just don't hear what we are saying. But when we tell objectively, you know, when you did like this, you know, I felt terribly hurt by that. Because, since I expected, this was what I expected. So when we, rather than making a value judgment about their actions, we focus on their actions. Then what happens? There are feelings and there are facts. Feelings arise from facts quite often. But, you know, the same fact may create one kind of feeling within us. The same fact may create some other feeling within us. So the problem in communication is that there are facts, but when we communicate with people, we focus on the feelings. We don't tell the facts. And then, how can you think like this? I never had that in mind. So we are telling our feelings, they are telling our feelings, and we feel as if we are in two different universes. There's no communication at all. So we have to focus on facts. We can definitely tell our feelings, because okay, this feeling, this fact, or this action created this feeling within me. Because of this. But start with facts. Start with facts, then come to the feelings. And they say, oh, actually, this was not my intention at all. Or, oh, I'm sorry I did like this. I did or not. So they will clarify. And things will be resolved that way. Oh, so that means, the one extreme is, they have no intention of changing. Then we just take corrective action. Second is, we express our emotions and then we observe. So then sometimes we may find that by that communication, they may change. If they change towards the positive, they give up that kind of, they truly repent that kind of behavior and they correct that behavior, then we may start trusting them. And then when you trust them, the relationship may become restored. Sometimes still that, so the best solution is that through the clarification, there is rectification, there is apology, there is change, and the relationship gets restored. Otherwise, one extreme is the relationship comes back to normal or becomes stronger. The other extreme is the relationship has to be ended over there. And in between, there may be some functional mode at which we function, we keep some distance and we observe them. So there is no need to choke ourselves because we are feeling hurt, but at the same time, there is no need to alienate others by unregulated expression of our emotions. So by expressing ourselves maturely, with centered on facts rather than feelings, we can give that person an opportunity to clarify and rectify. And during that period, we keep a safe distance and we have communication. And then after that, if, depending on how they respond, we can choose how to move forwards. Did that answer your question?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Hare Krishna Prabhu. I am taking a question from your analogy where you said that what you cook, you must eat. So at the same time, suppose somebody has cooked something, he came to know about Sardharma Kaitan. Will Krishna throw that recipe into dustbin or?
Okay. So I said that what you cook, we must eat. But if we surrender to Krishna, does that Krishna throw that recipe into the dustbin? Yeah, actually, whatever our past karma is, Krishna takes control of the past karma and he orchestrates in such a way that it brings us closer to him. That means that when a devotee is working, when a devotee is functioning in the world, there is the rule of love and there is the rule of law. So for example, there is a young man who has committed a crime and then the person is caught by the police. And the police are chastising him, the police is maybe disciplining him. That is also meant for their good only. But that is one kind of discipline. But if the person has committed some mistake, and that person's father, young person, their father or mother are chastising them. How did you do like that? You should not have done like that. You know, in both cases, the action may be similar. There is disciplining, there is chastising. But there's a world of difference. When the police are doing it, it's the rule of law. When the parents are doing it, it's the rule of law. So like that, for devotees, it is not that when you start practicing bhakti, suddenly all problems will stop because we are surrendered to Krishna. Problems may still come. And when those problems come, what Krishna does is, he takes our stockpile of karma that is there and he lets it come in a way that helps us come closer to him. Sometimes Krishna will just remove the karma entirely. But the problem with that is, the problem with a problem-free existence is that we feel there is no need for Krishna. So quite often for us, it is only when we are in trouble that we feel the need for Krishna. So that's why Krishna may not remove all our problems completely. It is when the problems come, we intensify our devotion at that time. So, it is not that every single action that we have done, we necessarily have to go through that reaction. But it is also not that we should think that just because I have surrendered to Krishna, now I will have no problem, no reaction will come. Rather, we should recognize that actions have their reactions. And based on this understanding that actions have reactions, we become cautious in choosing our actions wisely. At the same time, when certain problems come in, we should not think that, oh, all my karmic reactions are coming, I don't know how much karma I have done, I don't know how much suffering I am going to come. Rather than worrying about that, we focus on Krishna. Krishna is in control and Krishna will make sure that through these problems, I will move closer to him. So let me stay devoted to him. So the same karmic reaction, whereas say for example, a materialistic person falls sick, you know, and they're in pain, they may just say, they may scream and cry. Devotee will call out to Krishna. That calling out to Krishna, it itself is purifying. That is taking them, taking them closer to Krishna. So that way, how Krishna will deal with the karmic stockpile of each person, that will vary according to what is best for that person's spiritual growth. And we should focus not so much on what Krishna is going to do for Guru, we focus on what we can do. If we focus on making the right choices ourselves, we will keep moving towards Krishna. And we'll grow through those situations. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Yes, any other questions? Yes, Mataji.
We were talking about that boy who was lost. The boy gets lost and some people will give him food, some people will give him toys. But the best is to take him to his parents.
Yeah.
So, in analogy to that, I would say you are in the place, you are like a person who is taking us to our parent. But we as professionals, like maybe we are not doing anything, so how to incorporate Krishna in whatever we are doing in our regular.
Okay. So, if we are professionals, then how can we incorporate Krishna in our daily lives, especially in terms of helping others?
Yeah.
Actually, there are different ways in which we all can serve Krishna. Now, those who are, there are the brahmachari sannyasis, there are the renounced order, there are the grahasthas who are the engaged order. And all of them are ultimately meant for the same purpose. It's like we are all in the same army fighting in different battalions, different divisions in the same army. So, for the purpose of teaching Krishna's message, that it is important that there are some people who devote themselves to focus study and share that message. But most people are at any time in the, they are going to be living in the world, having their careers, having their jobs, and being an active part of the world. So when we start practicing bhakti, when we teach about bhakti, people need examples of how bhakti is to be practiced while living in the world. So if we do our social, professional responsibilities, our family responsibilities, well, by practicing bhakti, while practicing bhakti, then that itself sets an example for people. So rather than seeing that connection, connecting people with Krishna is only giving them knowledge about Krishna. Yes, that is one aspect of connecting people with Krishna. But knowledge is only the first step. After that, the people, they become connected with Krishna not just through the knowledge. They also need inspiring examples. So if they see that, okay, my colleague is there, my family member is there, my relative is there, you know, by their practice of bhakti, they become better human beings. They become more caring, more sensitive, more calm. I would like to become like them. So we can also connect people with Krishna through our actions. So there is a segregated vision of bhakti where we think that okay, these activities constitute bhakti. Okay, coming to the temple, chanting Hare Krishna, reading the Bhagavad Gita, that constitutes bhakti. And we think other activities are not bhakti. But it's not like that. Bhakti is an integrated mode of living where all our activities are part of bhakti. So even when we are doing a family responsibility, we understand this is not just my family members. They are also parts of Krishna. And by taking care of them, I am also serving Krishna. When I am doing my job, when I am doing my profession, here also, this is, I am using certain talent, certain ability that are given to me by Krishna. And through this, through the way I act over here, I can share Krishna with others. Now specifically how we do that, you know, we may invite people to temple, we may give them some prasad, we may give them some books, we may connect them with some spiritual websites, whatever. How we do that will vary according to their time, place, circumstance. But we have to have this integrated vision where we see, yes, there are some activities that are directly devotional and they are important. They need to be done. But along with that, all our activities are also connected with Krishna. And Swakarmanatam Abhyarcha Siddhim Vindati Manava. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, by your work, worship Him. And by that, you will attain perfection. So by associating with devotees who are also in a similar situation like us and seeing how they are practicing bhakti, how they are sharing bhakti, we can learn it more and more. But overall, we should know that service of Krishna or connecting others with Krishna is not limited to a particular situation. Everybody can play their part in connecting people with Krishna. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, jara dekho tare kaho Krishna updesh, amara agya guru hoy tare ek desh. So where you meet, you tell them about Krishna. And in this way, you become a guru for them. And you share Krishna with them. So we all can connect Krishna connect people with Krishna by sharing His message or by setting an example of living His message or providing facilities for people to connect with Krishna. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Hare Krishna. Yes, Prabhu.
Prabhuji, many a times we as youngsters, when the time comes to choose a profession, we get confused as to what to choose, because some of us, we are trained as doctors, engineers, chartered accountants, and at the same time we are good in some other field like sports or your own your music or something like that. When you ask your elders, one school of thought says, oh, you are trained in such and such thing, so you may practice your profession as your doctor, engineer, side by side as a hobby you may choose it. And another school of thought goes as to whatever you like, it's your passion, go, follow it, do it, lest you repent in the future. So how do you draw a nexus between you're good in that and you love to do that?
Yeah, that's true. So if we are trained in a particular field, say as an engineer, a doctor or something like that, but we have a passion for something else, maybe music or sports or whatever, so should we pursue our career according to what we are trained, or should we pursue that which we have a passion for? This is something which we all have to individually take stock. See, there are our feelings which come and go, and there are certain feelings which stay steadily. So for example, if right now, generally the tendency of the mind is to think that, okay, I want to act according to my nature. And you say, what is my natural for me? I'll do that. And the mind says, whatever you are doing, that is not your nature. So the mind's nature is to be dissatisfied with whatever we have. That's the nature of the mind. Even if somebody is doing, say, if somebody wants to become a cricketer, and then they become a cricketer also, you know, it's not that just because they become a cricketer they are satisfied. They say, you know, I want to be opening batsman, but they have made me a middle order batsman. You know, actually, the nature of the mind is wherever we are, it will keep us dissatisfied. So we can't just let our actions, especially in terms of our career, be determined only by our mind's feelings. Our feelings are important, but we shouldn't make them all important. So it is good for us if we have certain strong feelings or if we have certain reservations about what we are doing. See, changing one's career is a very major decision and is going to affect our own whole life. But rather than taking it based on impulse, we can give some time for ourselves. So for example, if we have trained ourselves in a particular career, then if we have some reservations about that, write it down. The journaling is a very good way of self-understanding. So for example, if I write down my feelings, okay, I don't feel inspired to do this because of this. And I feel inspired to do this because of this. So when we write down, you know, what happens is, writing down our thoughts and our emotions, that helps us to get a snapshot of our inner world. It's like when we go to some beautiful places, we take snapshots as a memory of we have gone there. So writing down gives us a snapshot of our inner world. And then keep taking snapshots regularly. You know, maybe every once a month, write down. Or maybe once a week, write down. And then if you find that the same kind of thoughts are continuing regularly, not just once, not just for 1 week or 2 weeks, but they go on for 3 months, 6 months, 1 year. If the same kind of thoughts go on, then we understand this is actually a very strong calling within. This is not just a passing inclination. This is a very long-lasting ambition, aspiration within. And then we may decide to pursue that. So by taking a snapshot of our mind through journaling, and the important thing is, don't just chew on it constantly. How should I do this? Should I do that? Should I do this? Should I do that? You know, when we are just too caught up in indecision, that creates insecurity. That creates unproductivity. So if we are in a particular situation, act wholeheartedly in that situation. If you train in a particular way, act wholeheartedly what you are doing right now. And while doing that, if some thought comes in our mind, this reason also is there. Okay, have some diary or something, just note it down at that time. Don't spend too much time thinking about those things constantly. Have some time on a regular basis where we can contemplate that. Maybe once a week, you put down time and write down a journal for half an hour or 15 minutes or whatever. Okay, these are the thoughts which I have about this. And by that, eventually, even if we have to consult our elders, we might have to consult our spiritual guides, our parents, our friends, then if we have done our homework properly, just like if I go to a doctor, I need to tell what my symptoms are. If I go to a doctor and I tell, you know, I am having fever, but then after I come back, I had cough also, I forgot to tell I had cough. Then the doctor cannot give proper prescription without giving the diagnosis unless we give the symptoms properly. They cannot diagnose and they can't prescribe. So like that, when we are, when we want to consult others also, if we have diagnosed ourselves properly to some extent, at least in terms of recording what we feel, then we more clearly understand what our inspiration is, what our reservations are, what our talents are, and then we can take a more mature decision. So we shouldn't think of our nature only in terms of that which for which we have passion. Because what we consider as our passion, that might also be largely determined by circumstances. So it, because the, in a particular culture, this particular activity is glamorized, so I think that I have a passion for that. But I may or may not have that passion. So if we consistently observe ourselves for some time and keep observing our mind, then we'll be able to understand, okay, this is what I consistently feel like. Then we may choose that course of action. The important thing is that such a decision comes from more from our inner strengths, our inner inspirations, not outer pressures. Normally we think of outer pressures only in terms of, say, okay, society tells me you have to become an engineer, you have to become a doctor, and I am becoming like that. We think that following certain standard career charts, that is what we get a pressure towards. But actually, apart from those career charts, there may be certain things which are glamorized. Maybe sports career is glamorized, or movie career is glamorized. You may think I want to go. So that may also just be because external pressure of a different kind. So you know, they say that that one extreme is to say that, you know, whatever my elders say, I just follow it. And when that is always emphasized too much, when the hippies, they had a culture, if my elders say it, it must be wrong. So rather than saying that, you know, my elders always have to be right or my elders always have to be wrong, we have to recognize that rather than making it absolute, we understand ourselves better, we understand our elders better, we can have proper discussion, and then we can arrive at a mature decision. There's no need for life-changing decisions to be taken hastily. They have to be taken patiently with a due deliberation. And if we observe ourselves over a consistent period of time, then we'll be able to understand ourselves better. And then we'll be able to get others' guidance also in a more effective way. And then we'll be able to take the decision. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, please. Yeah.
Hare Krishna.
Yeah. Prabhuji, the feelings, intuitions which we get, the inner voice, basically is it something which is taking us to our destiny, or is it the Lord's voice to us? Like, how should we interpret it?
Okay. The inner voice that comes to us, is it taking us towards our destiny? Is it the Lord's voice? Yes, it can be, but it is not necessary. That everything that is inside the inner voice is always the positive voice for us. One time, Srila Prabhupada, in the early days, one young hippie devotee, he came, Prabhupada, yesterday you came in my dream and you told me to take drugs. So Prabhupada said, that was not me, that was Maya coming in my car. So it's not that always the inner voice is the voice of God. So we have antar bahir ashubham vidhanvan acharya chaitya pusha swagatim vyanakti. The Bhagavad in the 11th canto in the Uddhava Gita, it is said that the Lord guides us from within and from without. Internally, He guides the Chaitya Guru as the Paramatma. Acharya chaitya pusha swagatim vyanakti. Externally, He guides us through the scriptures and the sages. So when we study scripture regularly, when we associate with devotees, then we start understanding the overall principles that Krishna wants us to live according to. And the more, ultimately it is not that Krishna wants to keep the right path hidden from us. Krishna wants us to give the guidance, but He wants us to see how much, He wants to see how much we want that guidance. So whenever the choices of right and wrong, of the proper and the improper course of action are clear for us. And at that time, we choose the right actions. And what are right and wrong, we understand based on Guru Sadhu Shastra, the sages and scriptures. Then when we choose the right course of action, when the right is clear to us, then at that time, more and more, we are showing Krishna that I want to be guided. And then Krishna will guide us in other situations also. So in general, the inner voice, if it is in harmony with the broad principles that we have learned from scripture, from the sages, from the devotees, then what we understand is this is Krishna's voice. If it is something which is not really connected with Krishna, but it is taking us away from Krishna, then we understand this is not Krishna's voice. And if it is not really neither directly pro-devotional or anti-devotional, then we may have to just, as they say, play by the finger. We may try it out and we learn, okay, when I act on the impulse, it is sometimes works well, sometimes it doesn't work well. So we can't always say that the inner voice is bad or the inner voice is good. We learn from scripture and we learn from experience. So it is possible that sometimes we may get a hunch and we act on it and it works out good. But sometimes we act on the hunch and then we later realize there's not a hunch, this was simply a rush of blood. You know, I did acted very impulsively and I should not have acted like that. So there is a certain amount of self-observation that is required. So we may not always know right in the beginning when a particular some prompting comes from within whether I should do this or should not do this. But we shouldn't, rather than making assumption that this is the voice of Krishna or this is the voice of Maya, we use the intelligence that we have got based on Guru Sadhu Shastra to evaluate that. And then we further evaluate that in the light of our experience in our life. And by that, we can act properly. So our voice, there are many voices within. And the voice of Krishna is also there within. So everything that comes from within is not necessarily Krishna's voice. Does that answer your question?
Also, Prabhu, just a further answer to this question. So the inner voices, the intuitions we get when the mind is calm, can they be said to be more correct or compared to when the mind is agitated, the inner voices we get at that point of time?
Okay, when the intuitions that we get when we are calm, are they always more likely to be correct than when we are agitated? Possibly, but not necessarily. Usually, when we are in goodness, at that time there is tamoguna, rajoguna, sattvaguna and shuddha sattva. So when you are in goodness, it is more easier to connect with pure goodness. So it is easier to connect with Krishna. So in that sense, when we are calm, the illumination that comes may be coming from Krishna more likely. But it's not necessarily, because Krishna's intuition can come anywhere. It can come in a dream, it can come... You know, there is an example of one scientist. You know, he was trying to solve some problem and he was just working, not getting any idea. And once he was just in a crowded metropolis, he was trying to catch a bus. And as he was catching the bus, as he was climbing and holding on to the bus, suddenly he got an idea. He was so caught in the idea, he actually fell back from the bus. And there, you know, it's a complex mathematical problem. There is no way at that time he could have done the mathematics and he could have got a conscious solution. He was lying on the ground and people were around him, what happened to you? And he was delighted, yeah, I got the solution. So, it may work out that Krishna's guidance can come to us at any time. But, we should focus not so much on when we are getting the guidance, but whether that guidance makes sense in terms in the light of Guru Sadhu Shastra. And yes, we all can evolve certain, if we observe ourselves, we will learn that, okay, in these situations, I think more clearly. In these situations, my thinking becomes fuzzy. And we can try to put ourselves in situations where our thinking is more clear and then take decisions or then seek guidance for taking decisions. At the same, so that means if something is favorable for clear thinking, we should use that. But we should know that the intuitions, they don't necessarily depend on that. They can come anytime. And we should be open for that at all times. Does that answer your question?
Thank you. Just one more question.
Can you come to me back? Can you come to me later if you don't mind? Yeah.
Hare Krishna Prabhuji, in terms of forgiveness which you mentioned, does forgiveness justify the act done or the hurt caused by the other person? And does the debit credit of karma get cancelled there when we let go? Does it go on to the next life or is it just cancelled there?
Okay. So does forgiving someone mean that the karmic balance ends over there, or still it is carried over to the next life? There are multiple aspects to this. See, forgiveness is a matter of, as I said, as an emotion, we should always forgive so that we are not driven by a vindictive mentality. At the same time, actions have reactions. So if somebody has hurt me and I forgive them, does that mean that from the law of karma point of view that now there's no more consequence of that wrongdoing? It's not like that. That action was a wrongdoing and there are consequences of that. But the fact that that other person forgave, or the fact that this person sought forgiveness for that wrong action or tried to do some correction, that is taken into account. And that is taken into account, the consequence or the magnitude of the hurt that is there, the magnitude of the reaction that is there, that will be decreased. So it is not that forgiveness erases the karma. Forgiveness, what it does is, it can help in minimizing the karma. Especially when it is in a devotional context, where the person is also trying to practice bhakti, to rectify not just that particular wrongdoing, but rectify overall the mentality for doing wrongdoings, then forgiveness is very empowering in terms of minimizing the karmic reactions. But we can, rather than thinking of karma as purely a mathematical thing, you know, you hurt me like this, therefore you have to get a reaction of 1000. And now I forgive you, your reaction is going to become 0. It's not like that. The law of karma is not like exactly mathematical. In fact, the whole idea of wrongdoing and ethics, this cannot be mathematically quantified. The principle here is, karma is a mechanism to reorient us in the right direction. And so whatever punishment also comes, the purpose of the punishment is not to hurt, is not to injure, is not to cause pain. The purpose of the punishment is also to reorient and reform. And forgive, the act of forgiving from our side means we are not holding on to a vindictive mentality. And the act of seeking forgiveness from their side and actually acting in a reform way from their side is also an indication that they are reorienting, that they are reforming. So, Gahana Karmano Gati, the Bhagavata 4th chapter, Krishna says, the intricacies of karma are very complex to understand. And rather than worrying too much about whether all the karmic accountability will be erased or not, we can understand that if we are reforming our mentality, then it is not that the law of karma is meant to catch us in. It's not that I have reformed, but still, hey, you did that bad, you will have to punish for that. It is not. Krishna is not a fault-finding God. No, it's not that he's waiting, hey, you did that wrong, I'm going to punish you for this. No. If we overall exhibit a mentality of reforming, then Krishna will take that into account and will help us to move closer to him. Does it answer your question?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Yes, any other questions? Okay. Yes, we'll come to you. Yes. Yeah. Does fate and destiny refer to the same thing? Usually the word fate has a negative connotation. That means when we say on a fateful day. So that means, you know, on some day when some very bad thing happened. So usually the word fate has a negative connotation. So when we say it was fated to happen, that means this particular bad thing was going to happen, something like that. Whereas destiny is used more in a non-judgmental sense. Destiny can be positive, destiny can be negative. But in terms of philosophy, so in terms of usage, fate has a more negative connotation, destiny has a more positive connotation. But in terms of philosophical conception, fate and destiny broadly refer to the same thing. They refer to the stockpile or the aggregate of our past actions for which certain reactions are going to come. Okay, one or two more questions. Yes, bro.
Sanjay, how do we manage the dualities in everything? Like, for example, when we are following sadhana, when we are doing sadhana, and at the same time we are doing business, materially, we are doing business. So when we do sadhana, we kind of develop a mode of goodness, and it's like we tend to get satisfied with less. We tend to see right and, I mean, everything as a plan of Krishna. But this thing is very hazardous for doing a business in a material world, because materially doing business means you should have profit, you should have the passion in it. So sometimes it so happens that there is a duality in mind that the more you are inclining towards goodness, your passion is getting reduced. At the other time, when we give more inclination towards passion, we tend to fear that the goodness is going down. So how do you keep a balance between
them? So if we practice bhakti, we come to goodness and we tend to be satisfied with what we are doing. But when we are trying to do business, we need to be competitive and we have to seek profit. We need passion over there. See, it's not that passion is necessarily bad. Nor is it that goodness is universally a virtue. All these three modes are part of nature. And passion has a function. Goodness has a function. Ignorance also has a function. So it is when we are in the mode of ignorance, basically we become inactive. At the time when the body gets rejuvenated, when we take rest. When we sleep. So all the modes have their function. The point is, the intention to serve Krishna is what is most important. So the Brahmanas serve primarily through goodness. The Kshatriyas, the Vaishyas, they primarily serve, their functional mode is primarily in passion. But everybody can permeate whatever is the natural action with the mood of devotion. So, primarily what we should focus on is permeating all our activities with the mood of devotion. And for that, we do need a certain level of serious sadhana bhakti practice. Because then that connects our heart with Krishna. Once our heart is connected with Krishna, whatever else we do, that can be connected with Krishna. Along with doing that, depending on our individual natures, even a Brahmana can go into passion. Because somebody may be doing intellectual work, but intellectual work they are thinking, you know, okay, this work, I can get this much grant by doing this, and this can lead to this much prestige, this can lead to this much honor. Now, academics can also become very money-minded or very prestige-minded. So, even intellectual work can be done in passion. And even business, now there is a whole genre of, within business they talk about conscious entrepreneurship, conscious leadership, they talk about corporate social responsibility. So all this is within business also, there can be elements of goodness. Where people pursue business, not so much profit is a natural motive for business. It's a necessary motive for business. But profit does not have to be the only motive for business. The business can also be done for the purpose of value creation. Okay, I'm working in this particular field and I work to create value in this particular field in this way. And if I do that, while I'm creating value through what I do, along with that, profit will naturally come. So for it's not that as devotees we have to give up the mode of passion. When Arjuna was fighting a war, in the middle of the war field, it was not that he was worrying about cultivating goodness. At that time his focus was on fighting. So if certain modes of functioning are required for certain professions, we can have those modes. But our focus should be on ensuring that we have an attitude of serving Krishna. And for that we need to associate with devotees, we need to practice sadhana bhakti directly. And eventually, each of us will find what kind of functioning is comfortable for us. We shouldn't go towards an artificial renunciation which we can't sustain. So, it's just like, you know, some people can lift 20 kg weight very easily. Others can lift 30 kg weight easily. Others may lift 10 kg weight easily. Now, whatever weight you can lift, you take forward. So, some people... Now they can do one activity in a very focused way. Some people, they need to do 10 activities. Now they are doing this also, doing this also, doing this. Otherwise they feel like I'm getting bored. I'm not doing much. So, you know, we all have different natures. So rather than letting how others are functioning determine how we should function, we should focus on, okay, I have this kind of drive, I have this kind of inspiration. So if some devotees feel more inspired to do direct devotional activities, and others feel more inspired to focus on their business, grow their business and contribute to that business. We should always have an inclination, the intention to serve Krishna. But specifically how we serve Krishna, at what level we serve Krishna, that can vary based on our nature. There should not be any artificial repression of our essential nature. That will not be sustainable. And as we keep practicing bhakti, we learn over a period of time what is the best way we can function. Just like when we eat. Sometimes we may overeat and nobody can tell us you should do only this much, you know, eat only this much chapati or this much rice or this much this. So we learn by our own experience. So like that, with respect to our profession, how much we can function of that What is a balanced way of functioning, which does not cause too much agitation of the mind, and which does not cause too much dissatisfaction in terms of, oh, I'm not doing much, I'm not doing enough. So that balance, we learn by our own intelligence and our experience. And whatever mode our business requires, we cultivate that mode, but we accept that mode, but we permeate that mode with the intention to serve Krishna. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Okay, one last question.
Yeah, Prabhuji, in Mahabharata, Karna had Kavach and Kundal, and the day, in one fine, in the night time when he was sleeping, he got that dream that tomorrow morning a Brahmana is going to come and ask for your Kavach and Kundala, and you don't give it. But still he goes, and when he's asked for it, he gives it away. So was it, this was his destiny?
Okay. So when Karna got a dream that a Brahmana is going to come and he should not give to that Brahmana, the Kavach and Kundala, still he gives. So was that his destiny? No, not necessarily. Actually, the Mahabharata describes that it was, the Brahmana who came was actually Indra. And the voice that he heard in the dream was Surya. So basically there were the higher gods also were involved in all these activities because they were their progeny over there. Karna is a example of what happens when a lower value is made into the highest value. See, for Karna, he was a Kshatriya and he had the mentality of being charitable, mentality of being bound to his words, honor bound, all this is very good. But the problem with him was that there are ethics and there are levels of ethics. A moral crisis is when one choice is moral, the other choice is immoral. And then that requires strength of character to avoid the immoral choice and to make the moral choice. But an ethical crisis is when there are two choices, both are right. But which is more right and which is less right? That requires not just strength of character, it also requires intelligence to perceive properly. So for example, he had given his word that anybody who asks me for any charity, I will give that charity to them. This to be bound, to honor one's word, this is a very good value. But at the same time, there are other principles involved. He had told Duryodhana, I'll fight on your side. And he felt he was bound by that word. But when he gave that word to Duryodhana, right at the beginning, in their first meeting, in Drona's martial exhibition, at that time he did not know about the extent of maliciousness that Duryodhana had towards the Pandavas. And so when he started understanding, he eventually understood. See, if you look at the Mahabharata, initially, whenever the Kauravas are making some evil schemes, Karna opposes. When Shakuni says that let us send the Pandavas to the Varnavart and set their house on fire, so Karna opposes. Why do you want to do like this? You know, let's challenge them to a war and we'll defeat them. So Shakuni says, no, we'll not be able to defeat them. So basically, Karna has his conscience is still there, and he is recommending right choices. But eventually, as he keeps associating with the Kauravas, his sense of conscience becomes dulled. And because he gets his whole sense of self-worth from the Kauravas, they have given him the kingdom, they have given the honor of being a Kshatriya. So his innate sense of right and wrong gets suppressed by that. And eventually it goes to such an extent that it is he who proposes, suggests that Draupadi be dragged into the assembly and disrobed. And he calls Draupadi a prostitute. So all that is horrendous. Of course, to his credit, he regrets it later. But the point is, in terms of ethical choices, there is the choice of sticking to one's word. So I wrote an article on this, which is published in Back to Godhead. Karna's choice, word of honor or life of honor. Word of honor is important, but in the name of word of honor, if one has to live a life devoted to somebody who is dishonorable. So that is a wrong choice. So it was not that Karna was destined to act in wrong ways. He chose to act in wrong ways. So it was his destiny to be put in that situation where, you know, he had some Kshatriya qualities, but he was not known as a Kshatriya. He did not get the proper education in Kshatriya. That was his destiny. But within that destiny, he could have made choices. And he got abundant counsel from various people to make right choices. But unfortunately, he chose wrongly. When Krishna came and invited him to come on Pandava's side, at that time he rejected him. And that was a choice which sealed his fate. So it's not, our choices are never destined. The circumstances that accompany the choices, they may be destined. But our choices are always up to us. But by our choices that we make, we may seal our destiny. So once Karna told that I am going to fight on the Kaurava side, then Krishna told him, then we will meet on the battlefield. And that is where you will be meeting your end. And he also knew that it's going to happen. So it is not that our choices are controlled by destiny. It is our circumstances are controlled by destiny, and our choices are what we do. And by that we seal our destiny. Otherwise our destiny is quite open for positive reshaping. Okay? Okay, one last question. Is some question here? Yes, ma'am. Oh, okay. Yes, ma'am. Okay. Yeah. So, if there are psychological disorders, do they need to be medically treated, or can devotion be used as a substitute? When we talk about psychological disorders, there are various kinds, and we cannot make any generalization. So, for example, there is this whole tendency within the mental health industry to try to find chemical solutions to human problems. The human problems means there is anxiety, there is grief, there is loneliness. Now, all these are human problems. And these are problems which we all face. Just by our very being human, we have to face these problems. And the whole commercialization of mental health has led to a lot of exploitation. There are several of these. In 1956, the first antidepressant drug was introduced. And when within 5 years, that antidepressant drug became practically among the top 5 selling drugs in America. And now some of the companies which sell antidepressant drugs and things like that, some of those countries, their budgets are bigger than the budgets of entire countries in the European Union. And in those companies, actually they spend far more on marketing than on research or production. So what happens is, rather than solving existing problems, often these advertisements and this promotion, it pathologizes normal problems. So we shouldn't think that every time I have some anxiety, I have some fear, I have some irritation, or I have some disorder. There was but well-known experiment which was done in England, that they had one patient, he was like one person who was made a subject, and he was sent to 6 different mental health professionals with the same set of symptoms, and all 6 gave entirely different diagnosis. And they said, oh, you have this problem, you have this kind of disorder, and somebody says, you have this kind of disorder, you have this kind of disorder, and all 6 entirely different. Why is that? Because when it comes to mental health, it's not like there is no physical specimen. If I say that I got malaria, I can have tangible testing to prove that there is some malaria infection in my body. But if I say that I have got, say, a post-traumatic stress disorder, or I have got, what is that? Nowadays, children, they say they have it, hyper... Attention deficit and hyperactivity disorder. Yeah, ATHD. So when they say this, now actually, it might just simply be the normal restlessness of children. So the point is, when it comes to mental health, there is no very concrete, verifiable, tangible, measurable symptoms. A lot depends on the what the patient tells and what the health professional stresses, and they can give very widely varying diagnoses at that time. That's why we need to pathologize every single problem. So if there are some anxiety, there is some irritation, there is some frustration, there is some pessimism, there is some depression, there is some inferiority complex, whatever. It's not that for all these immediately we have to go to some doctors and check it. No, we should talk with our friends, talk with our relatives, talk with devotees, and we can and try spiritual remedies. That means, you know, if we connect with Krishna more and more, if we fix the mind on Krishna, we remember Krishna's love for us, and that doesn't mean necessarily chanting. If we have to find out, the point is to connect ourselves with Krishna. Chanting is an important way to connect with Krishna. But different devotees may be able to connect with Krishna differently. Some may find through music they are more connected. Some through the philosophy they may get more connected. Some may get more connected through taking darshan of deities. So basically, is we connect ourselves with Krishna, and by making Krishna the anchor of our inner world, we decrease the agitation in the inner world. That is a recommended solution, and it does work on many occasions. At the same time, we shouldn't think that if some devotees need medical attention, some people need medical attention in terms of, some people may have clinical depression, where it's not just a problem of just they are feeling let down, there are certain chemical imbalance in the brain, and that's what is required to be healed, that's what is required to be treated, then there should not be any stigmatization of the need for medical attention, for therapeutic attention or pharmaceutical attention. If that's what is required, that's what should be given. So when there is stigmatization, then even when people need attention, they don't take attention. They don't take that, and they unnecessarily have to suffer. So I know one devotee, he just could not sleep. For 7-8 years, he was just not able to sleep. And then he thought, what is this? Why am I not able to sleep? Then finally, he went to some doctors to get diagnosed, and found there was some particular chemical that was deficient, not letting him sleep. And then he took that immediately. From the next day, he was able to sleep well. So, of course, sleep is not necessarily mental alone, but it's a whole thing. He thought, maybe I'm too anxious or too stressed because I'm not able to sleep. So the point is, especially if something can be diagnosed in terms of some tangible, structural or biochemical disorder in the brain, intangible, it's not just conceptual, but tangible, then medical health, taking mental health treatment is fine. It should not be stigmatized, but it should not be the first course of action that is sought. And as the devotee community expands, if we can have devotees who are in mental health profession, then that can be very helpful. Because sometimes those who are in mental health profession, they often recommend things that may not be devotional, that may be actually anti-devotional. So which is also not very good. Often mental health professionals, they work on a particular kind of paradigms which are very tentative and experimental. So for example, because of Sigmund Freud's ideas, they had the idea that, whatever problems we have, that is because we are not expressing our emotions. So these are actually, historically they have been done. They think that if you just give vent to your expression, then you will actually solve your problems. So they, in the 1960s, there was a lot of racial tension between the whites and the blacks. So they, as an experiment, they thought, get the whites and the blacks in one room and let both of them vent out whatever they feel. And after they have vented out, then the emotions will get exhausted and they will become pacified. But actually what happened was the entire opposite. Because, if we start venting out everything that is in our heart, then you think like this about me, you think like this about me. It is practically, they started out venting out, and when by the end they were at blows with each other. That is one of the biggest, most disastrous experiments in mental health care. So, within mental health care, if there is something which requires biochemical or structural correction, that can be taken. And if we can have people who are devotional or professionals who are devotional, or at least who are sympathetic of devotional profession of devotional principles, then their guidance is the best in such situations. But we shouldn't assume that by nature devotion alone will be a substitute for mental health problems, because the mind is also material. The mind is not spiritual. Just as if I have a digestive problem or if I have a fracture of a hand, it's not that I expect that chanting Hare Krishna will cure the fracture of the heart, fracture of the hand, or chanting Hare Krishna will cure my digestion. So the spiritual is not necessarily a substitute for the material. The spiritual is the director of the material. The spiritual enables us to direct the material constructively. So Arjuna got the spiritual wisdom of the Bhagavad Gita. He won the war of Kurukshetra not by the wisdom of the Gita. He won the war of Kurukshetra by using the skill of archery which he had learned throughout his life. But he would not have been able to use that skill of archery if he had not got the inspiration from the spiritual wisdom of the Gita. So the spiritual and the material in this case were complementary. The spiritual gave him the inspiration and the motivation to act, and the material gave him the practical skills to act. So now, with respect to gross material things such as fighting or eating or fracture, we can easily understand that the spiritual and the material, the spiritual doesn't substitute for the material. But with respect to the mind is subtle material. And when you talk about subtle material, that means there are certain emotions within it which may be unregulated and wild, and they can be controlled by spiritual practices. When we get spiritual satisfaction, they can be controlled. But Krishna also talks, for example, that that our own basic nature cannot be changed. He says, Sreyansva dharmo viguna pradharma samishtita. He tells Arjuna, like Kshatriya, you cannot act like a Brahmana. It is not that by practicing bhakti, a Kshatriya will go to become a Brahmana. The mind of a Kshatriya is going to stay as the mind of a Kshatriya. So, the spiritual and the material, when it comes to the level of the mind, it has to be dealt with carefully. Some aspects of the mind can be healed by spirituality. Can be healed means in the sense of changed or purified or reformed. But some aspects of the mind need to be channeled. So, the lust, anger, greed, say, by practice of spirituality, they will be curbed. But the Kshatriya nature, the Brahmana nature, that cannot be curbed. That has to be channeled. So when it comes to the level of the mind, you know, whether the spiritual will completely heal whatever is the mental level, or the mental level needs to be channeled in a particular way, or the mental is connected with the brain and it needs to be biochemically treated, this has to be decided on a case-to-case basis. So there should not be, first, as soon as we have a problem, I jump to a psychologist or a mental health care. That should not be the situation. But if somebody needs it, there should not be any stigmatization. We are fighting a war, and whatever works, we can use it to make it work and continue our service to Krishna. Thank you very much. La Prabhupada ki Gaura Bhaktavinda ki.
I would like to thank His Grace Chaitanya Charan Prabhu for presenting this 3-day seminar on Make Your Destiny. And he also answered so many questions in a very shastric manner and also in a very practical manner and in a very comprehensive approach, in a very balanced manner. I would like to express our gratitude to him by loudly chanting in our traditional style. So, if anybody would like to mention any feedback about the seminar or any other aspects, any other topics which you would like to be